Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT. Bandwidth for Triangulation is brought to you by CacheFly at CacheFly.com. This is Triangulation, episode 263, recorded Monday, August 29th, 2016. Dane Jasper. Triangulation is brought to you by Epson's new EcoTank printers. With Epson's line of SuperTank all-in-one printers, you can print thousands of documents without running out of ink. EcoTank is loaded and ready to print when you are. Visit Epson.com/EcoTank to find out more. And by Tracker. Tracker makes losing things a thing of the past. Pair Tracker to your smartphone, attach it to any item, and find its precise location with a tap of a button. Visit thetracker.com right now and enter the promo code TRIANGULATION for 30% off your entire order. And by Automatic, the small adapter that turns your clunker into a smart, connected car. For more information on their brand new Automatic Pro adapter, visit automatic.com/TWIT. And don't forget to enter the limited time offer code TWIT for $20 off the new device. It's time for Triangulation, the show where we get together with some of the most interesting people in technology and get to pick their brains, and I get to learn a little, and you get to learn a little, and we call it Triangulation because usually it's me, our guest, and you in the chat room at irc.twit.tv. So if you're watching live, we do the show every Monday, 11 a.m. Pacific, 2 p.m. Eastern, 1800 UTC. You can ask your questions and comments and direct me, steer the interview. You may want to do that with this one. He's a return guest to Triangulation, someone I've known for probably a decade and have been a customer for at least that long. Dane Jasper is here from SonicNet. It's great to see. Oh, I can't call you SonicNet anymore.
Just Sonic.
It's just Sonic.
Yeah.
You're Sonic.com now.
We are.
I called you SonicNet. Wasn't that the company name?
Yeah, we called it Sonic.net,
yeah.
Just to make it very clear.
That's the website.
And then we acquired the .com, so
nice.
We started just saying Sonic. But
one of the best known and often considered, I think by many, the best independent internet service provider in the country because, well, you're famous for fighting for your customers' privacy, yeah. No bandwidth limits, no bandwidth caps, you know, giving customers what they want. And what I love about that is you've demonstrated that it works. You're growing. You're very successful as an ISP.
We're growing nicely. We were honored by the EFF, the Electronic Frontier Foundation, as the best internet access provider in the nation with
nice.
Respect to consumer privacy.
Nice.
And Consumer Reports recently ranked us number 2 in the nation. After an all-fiber carrier in Chattanooga, Tennessee.
Owned by the power company in
right.
Chattanooga.
So,
that's a great one.
So if you live in Chattanooga, Tennessee, they're the number one nationwide.
Awesome. But you can only get them in Chattanooga.
You can only get them in Chattanooga.
And thanks to Congress, you may not even be able to get them in the FCC. You may not be able to get them in Chattanooga. They're struggling a little bit.
Yeah, that's an interesting one. The case you're referring to overturns in a number of states. The idea of municipalities providing internet access
right.
has been challenged, and the FCC wanted to further that because
right.
they see these rural communities that are really underserved, and they'd like to empower these communities to take responsibility for their own access, and that's been overturned in court.
So it really should blame court, although if Congress wanted to do something about it, they could.
Yeah, and it's
obviously.
State legislatures.
Yeah.
So in a number of states, municipalities have been barred from competing with private internet access carriers.
Let me ask you about that. Actually, that's a great topic because the argument, of course, the people who managed to get state legislatures to overturn this, I think it started in Philadelphia, when Philadelphia did municipal Wi-Fi. And the ISPs, particularly Verizon and Comcast, which is based in Philadelphia, went to the state legislature and say, that's anti-competitive. We don't want to compete with the city. If the city offers free Wi-Fi, then it undermines our business.
Yeah.
And convinced the Pennsylvania state legislature, and I think it's 30 legislatures.
Quite a few.
30 states around there.
Yeah, and this has been sort of model legislation that ALEC has put forward. And
who's ALEC?
ALEC, the American Legislative Council. So they, it's sort of a conservative angle. you know, the idea is model legislation. Here's best practices.
I see. And free market.
If you're a large corporation and you would like your state legislature to protect you, and you've got representatives who are sympathetic to your cause, get them to pass this law, and you won't have to deal with competition from municipalities. And I have mixed feelings about it.
Because you are a private
enterprise. Yes, we are. And
in fact, you wired downtown Petaluma. You helped them do municipal Wi-Fi.
We did, and we've done new fiber construction in business parks and residential areas. And I don't like the idea that I'd compete with my own city where, you know, I'm paying taxes and, I build infrastructure, and then they get a 20-year tax-free bond. They have very low cost of money. They're building infrastructure that they could pass a bond measure and build a network that would compete with a private network.
Right.
That would be challenging for me on the one hand. On the other side, I'm really sympathetic to the communities where the cares that serve them haven't served them well.
The mayor of Chattanooga, Andy Berkey, says gigabit internet provided by the municipal power utility revived the city.
Yeah.
Literally turned it around economically.
And so from an economic development perspective, you need broadband. You need good, fast, inexpensive broadband.
And many cities, including, by the way, Petaluma, are hobbled by deals they made with the cable company. The regional cable provider has a monopoly. And the CLEX, the local phone company, those are the two providers to 80% of the United States. That's the choice.
Or the ILEC.
Not the ILEC.
Yes.
Not the CLEX.
And so I think municipalities should be empowered to build things, but I hate to see municipalities
go into competition with
being a full vertically integrated, triple or quad play provider. So, the idea that a municipality would build glass pipes to every home, like they would, build water lines or sewer lines that could be used by a broad array of carriers to deliver services, TV, phone, internet.
That would be great
home
for
alarms.
You.
That would be a win-win because a municipality could be empowered to take control over the construction of new infrastructure, make sure the necessary infrastructure is in place. That infrastructure really is potentially a natural monopoly.
Yeah.
You build this glass pipe to every house once, let everybody use it. But I am challenged, when I see an infrastructure like Chattanooga's EPB, it is a monopoly. What they've traded was kind of a crummy duopoly of a cable operator and an incumbent telephone company for a municipal monopoly over these services. That added one new competitor, but I think as you go forward for decades, what we'll find is that, municipalities are not great at innovation, disruption, customer service, keeping prices down. I mean, you wouldn't think of those characteristics being harnessed to government in general.
We interviewed, and I'm trying to remember his name, he's one of the two creators of VisiCalc, and his current bandwagon is exactly that, is that municipalities should either by right of eminent domain or through their own efforts create an infrastructure which they then allow competition, free market competition on top of as internet service providers. And you'd be happy with that.
Yeah, an open access municipal network that uses dark fiber.
Right. Don't light it up. Just put it in the ground.
Yes. Would be great.
Yeah.
And it would be...
Well, it'd take a lot of cost off your back.
It would. And
that's
expensive. It dovetails into a lot of benefits. A community wants to invest in its future.
Yeah.
They have access to very long-term and low-cost capital.
Right.
They want to bring more competition, and by not lighting it, they can eliminate the infrastructure costs of all the optics and routers, all the technology that needs to run over the top of it, and it just becomes fiber and splices, patch panels and plugs that go towards choose your carrier. That allows for innovation by the carriers. So, today they're going to deliver 1 gigabit. In future, they're going to deliver 10 gigabit. And they might bundle it with one thing or another, or they might deliver great customer service or a great price point.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas a lit open network...
Chattanooga's.
Well, Chattanooga's is not open.
Oh, it's not open. Right.
So Chattanooga's is vertically integrated.
Right.
You buy all the services directly from the EPB.
Right.
A good example of a lit open network was the Utopia network in Utah. And so government-run operation in a number of cities. You could choose from a number of providers. But what this all boiled down to is an Excel spreadsheet you download that literally shows, here's the five providers, here's the three speeds, here's the price points for each of the
speeds. You choose.
There's no innovation between these. Like, everybody's got a gigabit.
It's a commodity.
Everybody's got a 200 megabit.
Yeah.
And what that will likely result in is then a race to the bottom with respect to both price and therefore customer service.
Right.
And whereas a dark network, if you put dark fiber in the ground, the best example of that is StockAB in Stockholm. And the StockAB network is dark fiber, glass pipes.
Owned by the government.
Owned by the government or owned by a captive entity that is controlled by the government. If you want glass to a premise, you can get glass to a premise. If you want to build on that, an active Ethernet product, a private line product, a secured product, if you want to deploy commodity, EPON, which is the cheapest way to do it, you could do that. If you wanted to deploy, 10 gig active Ethernet, the most expensive way, you could do that. And that continuum of technology and the fact that that technology can get refreshed every 5, 7, 10 years allows carriers and service providers to disrupt. So one might deliver IPTV, another might do RF over the glass, mm-hmm. Modulate the signal over glass. Well, that's a cheaper way to do it. And the products would be differentiated. And so I'd love to see open access in dark.
Of course, that's cost on the city to provide the infrastructure, or the federal government, in the case of Sweden, to provide the infrastructure. The benefit, though, to the citizenry is the money they've put in there is going to guarantee them not only choice, but some pretty good choices in terms
products.
Of speed, some great products.
And that's
Can you guarantee that? I mean, is it possible you'd lay the dark fiber and people go, yeah, no,
Well, and that's a challenge, and I think there was a municipality that was building a vertically integrated infrastructure, and I wrote to them and said, why don't you run this open access?
Yeah.
And they said, we don't have enough parties that are interested in using it.
Precisely, yeah.
And I think that would be a real challenge, particularly with the two incumbents. You have a telephone company and a cable company.
They don't want to do
They don't want to get on
this
board
is bad news
because this is bad news,
yeah.
right?
Yeah. This is a competition.
Yes, and so if they can withhold their participation,
right?
And if therefore the utilization rate is low, maybe this thing fails and you have a bankruptcy
right.
of this municipal
right.
effort. And so this is a case where we really celebrate the free market, but we have market failure around broadband access in America.
Oh, that's clear. We're talking to Dane Jasper. He's the CEO and founder of Sonic, which is a internet service provider that is available here in our area, but also in many other areas. We're going to talk about that. And a disclaimer, which I should have probably done up front, but I'll do it now, is a future advertiser on our network, which we will be thrilled about.
Yeah, thank you.
I've been wanting to get you on for a long time because I've been a Sonic customer for a very long time. And we're really pleased to say our internet service provider here at the new studios, Eastside Studios. In the old studios, we had Sonic. We had, I think, an ADSL product from Sonic.
It was an Ethernet over copper product.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Yeah. And that was a backup for you guys.
Yeah, because we were able to get Comcast to trench to our studio all the way down Keller Street and put fiber in for us. But that, at its best, was 100 megabits per symmetric from Comcast, an additional 50 from you guys, a top of 150. We have 10 gigabits just from you alone in here. That's fiber.
Yeah. So
how come it's so much more fiber? Well, actually, I want to take a break. We'll talk about that.
Right.
And there's so many challenges, and there's so much debate over broadband and why we have such bad broadband in the U.S., where the failure was, what we can do better, and this is a really important conversation. I think getting the perspective of an internet service provider is really important, and not one of the duopoly incumbents in most markets, which is your cable company and your phone company. They have very much vested interest.
Yeah, they would argue that there's nothing wrong.
Everything's perfect. It's fine.
We're doing great.
You're happy, aren't you?
Yes.
But we can do better, and I think, thank goodness that Sonic exists, because I think... I call you an independent internet service provider. I think you're at the point now where, I don't know if independent's the right word for you. You're big enough. But CISPA, the California Independent Internet Service Provider,
yes.
You've been a president of CISPA in the past.
I was, and that organization, I mean, it's been interesting to watch the trade organizations of independent ISPs.
Yeah.
And, there were at a time, there were thousands of internet access providers, or dial-up providers.
Shrunk, hasn't it?
And so that group, that California ISP Association, there was 130 members, and today that group has 13 members, and it's really dying.
One tenth the size.
And many of those businesses are not growing anymore. I think Sonic is an anomaly. We need 50 Sonics across 50 states.
Well, good. So if you're watching at home, you can be the next Sonic. We're going to find out. We're going to get the roadmap from our guest, Dane Jasper, on Triangulation. Our show today brought to you by Dane was like, we were talking about these EcoTank printers. He said, wait a minute, come on. How did they do this? You said you were at a grocery store and you were offered a printer for $20.
At the checkout line.
At the checkout line.
They had them stacked up against the wall.
Right.
Like, can we throw this in your cart? It comes with very little ink.
$20. Yeah. It's a demo amount of ink.
That's
you're going
right.
to be going back to the store pretty quick. That's the old model. And I have to really applaud Epson for deciding it's worth doing it a better way, better for customers, and I hope better for them, too, in the long run. I've been an Epson customer since the beginning. I'm sure you have, too, with the FX80, the MX80.
They make great printers. It was just frustrating to buy.
The ink.
Oh, yeah.
So these new all-in-one printers have tanks. They're super tank printers. On the side, we have now got two ET4550s. It's a wireless all-in-one printer. It doesn't use ink cartridges. It comes with 2 years of ink, about 50 cartridges of ink in the box. That's 11,000 black pages, 8,500 color pages. And when you come in the year 2018 to buy more ink, it's 80% less than the cartridges. So they're really giving up what was the revenue model for
inkjet. I wonder how they're going to.
Well, bravo, you know, bully for them. And it sure makes users happy. We, like I said, we have one at home and we have. Lisa, I just set up. Lisa's at work. I've set up two now. Very easy. You open it up. The ink is in the box. It's got a giant black bottle and a couple of, the cyan, magenta, and yellow bottles. You put them in the tanks. It's very easy. Not at all messy, but don't put the wrong color. Yeah. If you're going to have really bad printouts for a couple of years, make sure you get the colors right. It wasn't hard. I did it right. These printers, many of them, including the 4550, are powered by Epson's Precision Core technology. This is an incredible inkjet technology that comes down from their big industrial printers to give you really crisp black and white printing, beautiful, vivid color printing. Auto two-sided printing. One of the things I like about inkjets, there's no warm-up time. It just goes, and it's really fast. I mean, we're talking a couple of seconds per page, 3-5 seconds a page. It just bzz, 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 and it's out. And because these are wireless and they're multifunction, you can print and scan from anywhere in the Wi-Fi network. That's really handy. And nowadays, we all have phones and tablets. You can print directly from your phone and tablet with a variety of technologies.
So it's a photo printer?
They have photo printers. This one does. This one's more, I would say,
like a business printer.
Color. Although it does nice color, you can see the color is pretty good. But it's not a.
But it's not that glossy.
No, I wonder if you got the photo
paper,
that might be all you need. I'll have to look into that. Epson makes, of course, the best photo printers.
Yeah, that
in the
was
world.
Always my experience with
them.
Was using their photo printers.
Oh man, they know printers, and I love it that this is the 2016 Small Biz Windows Printer of the Year. It was the CES 2016 Innovation Awards honoree. The users and the market understand that Epson is doing a really good thing for everybody by eliminating the
everybody's
expense.
Sick of those tanks.
Yeah,
it was always the cyan tank that would run out on the photo printer.
Right,
and they expanded.
Colors.
Like you started out with four cartridges,
right.
And then they went to six, and
right.
then they went to eight.
Right.
I had a photo printer that had like
10. Your photo needs that.
And every single time I was printing a picture,
cyan.
One of them seemed like it was empty.
Yeah, right.
And so it wasn't like you'd wait 6 months and you'd replace them
I
all.
I still have
you'd be replacing one after another
cupboard,
at $30 a pop.
A cupboard full of cartridges because I have a Precision Core printer, the cartridge printer. And you have to. You have to have like several replacements.
Because
you never
know
when
one of these things is going to run out.
Don't worry about the 2 years of printing. Epson.com/EcoTank to learn more. They're transforming the way your home, your office, even your work group. They've got a big work group model that has 20,000 pages of ink in the box. For the best combination of ease and value, turn to the Epson EcoTank printers. EPSON.com/EcoTank. We thank them so much for supporting Triangulation and for doing, I think, something really important, the right thing for consumers. And I'm really proud to have them as a sponsor. Epson, exceed your vision. We're talking to Dane Jasper, CEO, founder of Sonic. When did you start Sonic?
1994.
And you were just a kid. This was like the earliest days. You were just a kid.
I was 21 years old at the time.
And I know you have a car. Your car license is Linux. You're driving a Tesla by now, right?
No? Yes. The Linux plate is on a Tesla. Okay. I got that license plate in 1992.
Wow. And when Linux was first invented, practically.
Very, very new. I was...
Yeah, nobody knew what your license meant.
Yeah. It's funny. I get, you know, people drive by and get a little thumbs up now and then. I'm not sure if they give me the thumbs up for the Tesla or the thumbs up for the Linux
plate.
Both,
baby. Both.
And, but, you know, the business has really been built on Linux. I think we've...
So you were kind of a geek at 21.
Oh,
and what were you just doing? I've known a lot of people who started ISPs this way. Well, I kind of know how to do this. I'll buy a wholesale... Internet, but even then, internet access was rare. What were you selling? Slip accounts?
Yeah. So we started out with shell accounts. And then slip and,
and then finally
serial
PPP.
And then DSL. It's been an interesting business because, you know, it started as a dial-up provider. So we had to learn about modems and phone lines and terminal servers and Linux. And then it became a DSL provider. And we had to learn about, you know, broadband aggregation and ATM infrastructure and all the core routing that enables DSL access and the relationships with the incumbents who ran the DSLAMs in all of our cities.
Right. Because you have to put your box in their office.
No. So as a DSL provider, they run the box in the office.
It's theirs.
They run the box in the office and they provide you an aggregation.
Okay.
And that was kind of the U.S. model for a while. And then as a CLEC, you then put your box in every office and you just buy the copper. And that's the CLEC model, is you put a DSL.
And that's what you're doing now for ADSL.
Yes. And so we offer VDSL2 and ADSL2 Plus products. And today, you know, that is, happily, that's a shrinking segment of our business. And
really?
Fiber is a growing segment.
Wow.
And
wow. I would have thought that's 80 or 90% of your business, but it's shrinking.
It is. And it's still, as a quantity of customers, it's still growing.
Right.
But
most homes don't have fiber.
Correct, but I'm really happy to see in really the sort of fourth instantiation of the business is fiber construction.
Nice.
So we had to learn each of these new things, you know, dial-up, DSL, CLEC, now fiber.
It's almost a different business each time.
It is, and so we've been doing it for 22 years now, but I don't feel like we've been doing the same thing.
Yeah.
Each nice. Technology iteration, we've had to learn all new regulation and all new technology, and, you know, when it comes to construction, you know, it's like digging holes in the ground.
I see hard hats. I see Sonic hard hats. Yeah.
And trucks and backhoes and directional drills and all that sort of stuff. And so it's been really enjoyable for me to take on all these new things. And just over the course of the last couple months, we've reached a point where on a daily basis, we're adding more new fiber customers than we're signing up on our legacy copper products. San Francisco
really
has really been the driver.
You just opened your fiber in San Francisco.
Yeah. So
Let's talk about what fiber is. Is it fiber to the home, fiber to a head end?
So we have three products. We have DSL products that are sort of third and fourth generation DSL.
And they ride on the phone company's copper.
They ride over the copper, correct. And, you know, what's disruptive about that is it's VDSL2 technology or ADSL2 Plus technology. We can combine that with pair bonding to double the performance. We bundle that with great customer service, good privacy practices, unlimited use. It's a great product.
It's a fabulous product. I've had it for years.
It's great. But it's not gigabit fiber.
It's not as fast. It's not even as fast, unfortunately, as cable. DSL is somewhat limited. How fast can ADSL2 go?
So ADSL2 Plus maxes out at 24 megabits.
That's pretty good.
And VDSL2 can hit about 75 megabits.
But you're constrained by the distance
from
the switch.
You're constrained by distance. So for this pocket of customers that get closer and closer...
Right around the central office.
The performance is great.
Right.
So, you know, we've got customers... I was really pleased to see we have a customer who's on VDSL at 130 megabits.
Well, that's pretty good.
But they're...
That's two pair?
Well, no, that's a single pair. Now, we say up to 75 is sort of the top because...
Right.
You don't see that. It's an outlier.
Right.
And this house is literally like you step outside of the central office, you throw a baseball.
It's next door.
You can break your window. I mean, it's right across the street. So that's not a common scenario.
Right.
But the DSL technologies have allowed us to deliver more performance, at least to those close. The second tranche of products is fiber to the node products, where we've got incumbent fiber going to a neighborhood gateway.
And somebody already dug the trench.
Yeah, and
put
we're
the
leasing
fiber in.
And we're leasing access to get to that last mile customer. And So that's kind of the evolution, central office to node. And now what you really want is fiber all the way to the premise, fiber to the business in your case here at the studio, fiber to the home, FTTH for residential customers.
Wow. And that usually means you're digging and putting in that fiber, right?
Yes. So there's, while in the copper arena, there's unbundling. So all competitive carriers and the incumbent share the same copper infrastructure.
This was something the FCC mandated. They never did with cable. That's why you can only get your cable company to give you internet access. You can't. Nobody else can ride.
So there's no unbundling on cable. Yeah. You know, this is a product of the 1986 Telecom Act. So this is an act of Congress in the mid 90s, which created, the intent was to create competition in local telecommunication services, business and residential phone service, as well as broadband.
And I'm sure I'm oversimplifying, but I would guess that in 96, the feeling is, well, the phone companies have now paid for their infrastructure. They've amortized the cost. They've had it in the ground for decades.
Well, and the ratepayers have paid for it.
Because
this was a
monopoly-regulated
rate of return business.
Were looking at cable, I would imagine, at that time and saying, well, we got to let them make some more money on their infrastructure before we mandate this.
Well, and what shifted there was leadership at the FCC.
Right.
So in 96, you know, we had a Democratic White House. We had a Republican Congress. This was a bipartisan act that was then implemented by the FCC. And then in 2000, we had a shift in the executive. So the executive became Republican. So the FCC chairmanship becomes Republican.
Mm-hmm. Michael Powell.
Yes. Powell and then Kevin Martin. And the philosophy shifted from one of open access and competition being a good thing to let's encourage the monopolies to invest in their networks by clearing the decks of competition.
Right.
If you don't have to worry as much about competitors, maybe you'll invest more in infrastructure.
It'll incentivize you to really build it
out. Yes, and the telephone companies were threatening not to invest in their infrastructure if they had to share it or sell it.
How come that didn't work for the phone companies?
And, well, it did in a way. So the break point where that occurred was copper and fiber. So what they said is, copper, that's yesterday's technology. The ratepayers have paid for it.
Right.
You have to open that up and share it. But if you build some new fiber out to a house, you have no unbundling obligation. So unlike European countries where the unbundling obligations have remained strong and thus consumers, whether they're served by the technologies of the past on copper or the technologies of today and the future on fiber, they'll have a number of carriers to choose from. Here in the U.S., you might be able to choose from 10 providers on copper, but maybe only one on cable and one on fiber. And
that's why.
As a fiber builder, if I build new fiber to a house in San Francisco,
I want to own that fiber.
And I'm the first one to bring fiber, being a monopoly sounds like a good thing.
Yeah.
But for America, for our economic development, for the benefit of the public, it would be better. And we started this out talking a little about, municipal dark fiber unbundling. Maybe there's a best model there. But, this is America. We're capitalists.
Right.
It's about a free market. And so the philosophies here have been around encouraging deployment and just letting people build. Although what we've seen recently, one of the real champions of new deployment was Google Fiber. And, it's been hitting the news the last couple of weeks, they've put a lot of their developments on pause.
According to the information, they've fired half of their employees. They've halved it to 500 people, which is still a good number of people, but it sounds like they may also no longer be doing fiber build-outs. They may be trying to look for other companies that have fiber in the ground and use that.
Yeah, and,
Is that as saying it's an economic failure or... Google changes its mind all the time.
They do. And whether it was, there's things that they've tried to do to push the envelope, and I certainly applaud them for that. And some of those things work and some don't.
According to the information, Larry Page told the CEO of Google Fiber, you need to cut costs 90%. It's too expensive. We can't make enough money off of individual customers to justify the build out.
Yeah, and I struggle to reconcile that with, what I see as a really viable opportunity. Consumers who have, only expensive cable from a cable company they might dislike, or a DSL product that isn't performing, if someone shows up with a fiber product, I feel like that entity is going to earn the majority of the market over a period of time.
But you're going against the stream, because now Verizon gave up first. Fios, they stopped doing Fios build-outs. That was a few years ago.
Yes.
Now Google said, maybe wireless. We'll go wireless. Then there's no infrastructure or less infrastructure. How is it you can make money doing exactly the same thing both of these companies said, we can't make money doing
It may be that they have a better opportunity. So you look at Verizon. Where should Verizon put its money? It's the largest mobile carrier in America.
That's where the money
should they put their money into mobile or fixed line?
Right.
You look at Google. Google is the largest advertising online advertiser in the country, and that is a business where they can really do transformative things that have a very rapid return on investment and a very rapid effect in reaching many consumers quickly. This is a
utility. And it's highly profitable, as we know from their last quarter. They're making a lot of money on it.
This is a utility business. You're building infrastructure, and it will have a very long return on it. But
you're willing to do this.
Well, and maybe that's because I'm not the nation's largest wireless carrier.
Right,
and
right.
If you were A, B between those two, maybe you'd put your money into that.
Right.
Similarly, if your business is primarily driven by advertising.
Right.
And if the advertising, and I think this was part of the creation of Alphabet and the siloing of some of the revenue, and they reported their other bets, and other bets included autonomous driving and X projects, as well as the access, the fiber arena. And by separating those, they could say, well, this stuff over here, those are long shots, but we'd like the market not to hold those against us in the same way. And then their advertising business could stand on its own. But they've encountered a lot of regulatory barriers, a lot of challenges from incumbents. And, in market after market, as Google has deployed, the incumbents have sought to sign customers up for long-term contracts, have upgraded their own networks, have beaten Google to market.
By the way,
it's a slog.
Yeah, and we thank Google for that, because if you're in a market where there's Google Fiber, we know Comcast charges you less, that Verizon offers you higher speed internet than they would have otherwise. Time Warner, which for a long time said nobody wants gigabit Ethernet or internet, as soon as Google marches into their market, they go, oh, hey, we have,
let's
guess what?
Some upgrades.
We have gigabit.
And you think about it from the perspective of Google as an entity running properties like YouTube, a very large video property, as well as the pay-per-click advertising, the more people use the internet and the faster the internet is, the better their business is.
That was always the rationale.
And the collector of tolls to get to the internet was, I think, a source of frustration.
Right.
So I think what we'll see is Google will build fiber to large apartment buildings that have already in place fiber to the building for a distributed antenna system or a cellular system, and they'll be able to deliver access to a small number of people in a large number of cities and maybe still move the needle with respect to consumers' desire for more performance. Will that keep the incumbents investing and upgrading? I don't know. And then there's wireless technologies and questions there about what happens with faster millimeter wave wireless or 3.5 gigahertz wireless.
I liken it to the homeowner. For years, we always talked about on the radio show, if you've got the walls open, make sure you put conduit in and maybe even put Cat 5 or Cat 6. Then it was Cat 6A, and then it was fiber. And then Wi-Fi it took over, and we said, I guess you didn't need to do any of that after all. Are we kind of in that situation in public internet?
I don't know. We're not at a point yet where it's cost-effective to deliver gigabit to residential homes with wireless. And I think we will see next year point-to-multipoint 1 gigabit technologies. But those technologies...
5G stuff.
So this will be like 60 gigahertz. It's in the millimeter wave category.
So it's very much line of sight.
Very much line of sight. And I would imagine it'll be expensive, and the issues will be distance. So an opportunity for an entity like Google or the company they acquired, Webpass, who focused on apartment buildings, is if you can get an apartment building owner to let you into the building, there's fiber into the building because there's a cellular provider in the building or on the roof, and you can serve people gigabit using that fiber within the building, and then use the roof to deliver millimeter wave to people that are within like 300 to 600 meters.
Okay. So very line of sight.
And very line of sight. So yeah. Some rooftops around there could get
rooftop to rooftop
a gigabit.
Yeah.
But that technology isn't yet available.
Right.
And then the other technology that has some promise is massive MIMO. So antenna arrays where you'd have 100 antennas that would sort out interference. That would mean a very expensive access point, but it could have much greater reach and some penetration because that can work in the, 3.5 gigahertz kind of range. And so getting that down into the spectrum that sort of where Wi-Fi lives, 2.4 to 5 gig, if you can get these massive MIMO technologies into the 3.5, say, then you could do hundreds of megabits to mobile devices over a relatively broad area, but it's not gigabit to your house.
Right.
And so it'll be interesting to see what happens here. And I think, this has been an interesting road for us and for Google. I'm really optimistic about, bringing fiber to people. They want it.
Yep. Boy, there's so much I want to ask you. It's when you finally get somebody who really knows what's going on, there's so many questions. Susan Crawford wrote on Back Channel a very interesting article about the difficulty of apartment internet providers and really the lock-in that the companies like Comcast have. Well, I want to talk about that. I want to talk about fiber and how you're doing it, how we're getting it, what the technology is behind it. It's not ATM anymore. And
no, it's here at the studio. It's just Ethernet point to point. So we brought you a 10 gig.
Oh, really?
We just brought you a 10 gigabit direct pipe. You're right into our backbone. And
I'm sorry. I shouldn't smile so broadly.
I know. Leo's happy.
That's an expensive product, we should point out.
It is not an inexpensive product. Yeah. This is not a consumer product.
Right.
The technologies that
But it's the kind of thing an apartment building might have where you have a lot of density.
Yeah, potentially. Yeah. And, yeah. We're bringing products that are greater than 1 gigabit to apartment buildings.
That's exciting.
And so it is exciting. Apartments are an interesting one. And
let's take a break. I want to talk about that. Okay.
We'll talk about Epson for a second.
And no, another sponsor.
Oh, all right.
We have many sponsors, including, disclaimer, Sonic very soon.
Yes.
I don't know when we start, but I'm excited about that. Dane Jasper is here, CEO and founder of Sonic, an old friend, a guy with the license plate Linux.
Yeah, and we're happy to sponsor you. It's you guys are doing great things.
We've talked for a long time about it, and finally we're doing it. Really pleased, really pleased. And part of it is that your business now is more than just the Bay Area. You're really expanding. You're in Southern California. You're in Texas.
We're in Southern California. We're in the Sacramento area.
Sacramento.
So far, limited to California. We're looking at other states.
But I think you have plans for...
We haven't reached that tipping point yet.
Yeah, okay.
But this is coming.
In a way, this is a test tube for what might work in other metros.
It is. And, we were started in Santa Rosa, and then it was Sonoma County, and then it was the Bay Area, and now it's California. So it's just natural. You keep going.
That's great. We're very proud to be part of this. Our show today brought to you by a tracker. Do you know the tracker? This is cool. This was a Kickstarter, I think. And now this is just the easiest way to keep from losing stuff. Do you lose your keys ever? Do you lose your pets? remote controls? The tracker. This is the Tracker Bravo. It's about the size of a quarter. It's lighter than a quarter because it's anodized aluminum. It's very light. It has a replaceable battery. It's about a year worth.
Do they all come with my face on it?
No, but you can. It's really cool. The tracker does allow you to do. They have some sort of UV.
I feel like the people who follow the link that you're giving in the sponsorship,
should
by default, it should just have your picture on it.
I thought so too,
don't
but apparently not. People seem to want their pictures of their dogs or pets. I don't know. I said, why aren't we offering this as an offer? And nobody wanted it.
No, they didn't go for that.
Go to thetracker.com. Actually, we do have a good offer. If you use the promo code Triangulation, you'll get 30% off your entire order. So you could stock up on Tracker Bravos, but also get the engraving if you want, or the special printing if you want. Now, here's the thing. These use Bluetooth LE. So they pair to your phone, Android or iOS. It's a two-way street, though, because every Tracker Bravo, see at the bottom, has a button. And if you lose, so if you have the Tracker Bravo on your keys and you leave your phone behind or you can't find it in the house, you press a button on the Tracker Bravo and your phone starts screaming. Even if it's on silent, it goes, hey, I'm over here, or whatever you choose. It could be just, Hell's Bells by AC/DC. Whatever you want to have that be, you can choose your ringtone. It goes the other way, too, of course. If your keys are left behind at the beach, Your phone has the tracker app on it, and it will have a map, and it'll show where it last saw your keys. Now, I know you're smart people, and you're thinking, well, wait a minute, Bluetooth only goes about 100 feet. What am I going to do if I get 200 feet away? Ah, that's when the Tracker Crowd GPS network gets so amazing. So they've sold 1.5 million of these. And if you look at the map at thetracker.com, you'll see they're all over the U.S. Anytime anybody who has a tracker on their and has the app on their phone spots your beaconing keys, the tracker on your keys or what, or your dog or whatever, their app will make a note of it and ping your app and say, hey, this is where we saw the keys. So you might leave them on the beach, go home. Maybe you left them, let's say you leave them on the blackjack table in Las Vegas, and you go home to San Francisco and you say, where did I leave my keys? Well, a lot of people in Vegas have the tracker app on there, and you're going to look and you're going to say, oh, they're on that blackjack table where I lost other things as well. And you find out where your keys are. It is kind of an amazing technology. This is the tracker. You can get it at thetracker.com. Use the promo code triangulation and get 30% off. Two-way separation alerts, the Crowd GPS network, and the Tracker Atlas. This is something Tracker put together, but it works with not only the Tracker Brava, but all third-party Bluetooth trackers. You can not only find out where your keys are in the house or your remote controls in the house, but you can see where in the house because you have a customizable map, a floor plan of your home, and the Tracker Atlas says, oh, yeah, they're there under the cushion. That is pretty amazing. This just gets better and better. Thetracker.com. Never lose your possessions again. Promo code triangulation for 30% off your entire order. thetracker.com. And the promo code is triangulation. Dane Jasper is our guest. He's at Dane on Twitter. I don't know how you got that.
Early days.
Very early.
Same way I got that Linux license plate.
It was easy back
being
then.
Being an old timer.
He is the CEO and founder back when he was 21 in 1994 of Sonic, which is an independent internet service provider that has grown amazingly, doing things that even Google and Verizon thought, maybe we won't do this fiber thing. How much fiber are you rolling out? When you say rolling out to San Francisco, how much of San Francisco?
So we've so far covered about 10% of the city.
That's a lot of trenching.
It's San Francisco has a lot of aerial utility lines.
Because rights of way are tough.
So rights of way aren't hard when you're a public utility. So we're a public utility.
Oh, you are?
We can dig a trench.
Oh.
I mean, that's how we
I didn't know that.
That's how we get to your office.
Oh, I didn't know
you
that.
You didn't see us out there with a drill
did,
and
actually.
Trenching up your...
Yeah.
Yeah. So anybody can be a public utility. I guess anybody. It's relatively straightforward to be a public utility.
What are the downsides? I see the upside, but there must be some... There's regulation, right?
Yeah, there's lots of regulation. And, you need to... not run it to everything else. You need to deliver a service to the public.
Right.
And, you've got some obligations there.
Right.
But, we're either hanging on poles or we're burying things underground. And, building across a huge chunk of San Francisco as quickly as we can. And then we'll move on to other cities.
How many strands do you put in when you put in fiber?
So every house gets a dedicated line to the house.
It gets its own strand?
That goes back to what's called a local convergence point, and a strand is split there, typically 32 to 1. So that's a point where you don't have any electronics. It might be a box on a pole, or it might be in a splice case or in a vault underground, and there's a passive splitter there that splits the signal between roughly 32 premises.
But what is the bandwidth of a strand of fiber? It's huge.
Well, it's really basically unlimited. It depends on what you want to invest in the equipment on
switches.
The ends.
Yeah.
And so what we're delivering to consumers today is a 1 gigabit connection.
But that's not even the top you could.
What we're delivering to you is a 10 gig.
Over the same strand.
You could deliver, Leo, if you want 20 or 40 or 100 gig, we can hook you up. And similarly with consumers.
I have to say our editors love having that much because it's 10 up too. So we have a huge amount of bandwidth.
It's great. And
that's mostly what you need for is uploading.
Yeah. And it was interesting. We talked to your team. Russell, who's great, who's working on the turnout, and they have trouble testing this.
Well, Lisa, of course, my wife and our CEO said, "Well, I want 10 gig on my desk." I said, "Honey, we could put a gig in; you wouldn't know the difference because you're faster than anything else you're visiting."
Yeah, and it's a challenge to get content that quickly.
Yes.
It's challenging to test it, and Russell said he kept you know, browser would crash or
yeah, you overload the browser.
And so he had some challenges with that. And
we split it down, obviously. I don't think I have a gig here. I don't know what I have, but
well, it's challenging. Well, most laptops and desktops have Russell's, 1 gig.
Is that Russell's post?
Yeah, so here's a test that Russell did. He got, you know, 5.5 gigabits demonstrated. And you can see it only got through about 25%, 20% of the test there. You see that little green arc above download. And then Firefox crashed. He frowny face right over the top of that. So he's had some trouble, you know, getting the client devices to go fast enough.
I'll take that.
That's great. And
but then you split it. I mean, nobody has a 10 gigabit connection at their desk, obviously. You
well,
split it up with
you business. Could bring 10 gigabit to Leo's desk. That's doable. This laptop's not going to go 10 gig.
But that's the problem. I can't get that.
But you can get devices that will go 10 gigs.
So are
you
there
can
devices?
You can build a 10 gig
this
workstation.
This probably has a gigabit Ethernet.
Yes.
Yeah.
And that's really common. So that's why gigabit service to the home is such a great fit, is that gigabit local area networking is inexpensive, and the end devices have gigabit
support.
Ethernet.
Right.
So it's really, there isn't much point to going beyond 1 gigabit to the home at this point because the local devices don't do it. But here in the studio, your video editing, your machines that you're doing video editing on, you can put 10 gigabit in those.
Yeah.
And obviously on Leo's desk.
We do it. I don't know. I don't need it. Right.
We'll put the 10 gigabit interface in and get you going full speed.
I don't want to crash my browsers. So what is the technology that is, what's the transport for that?
So, for the residential product or for the business
both.
Product?
Both. First of all, you got a backbone.
Yes.
So you're connecting to the backbone where and how?
So we run a fiber optic backbone around the greater Bay Area, around Los Angeles, and over to Sacramento today.
And you multi-home that to the internet?
So we run big rings. And so, for example, in the San Francisco Bay Area, we run a ring around the Bay Area, and then we interconnect at carrier hotels like Equinix in San Jose or Pax in Palo Alto, Tuner Paul in San Francisco, and
then they connect to May West from there.
Yes, and we'll buy transit at sites like that, and we'll also peer in sites like that.
Really?
So we do a ton of peering. We directly interconnect with entities like Apple and
explain
and
peering because we talk about that a lot. In fact, it's often said internet costs nothing because of peering arrangements. What is the story there?
So,
how does that work?
You know, if you are a regional service provider and you want to get traffic to Japan, you have to pay somebody to carry that for you. So you buy transit. But if your customer wants to watch a video on YouTube or download an update from Apple, and actually the majority of their traffic, so if you think Netflix plus YouTube, you know, Apple, Xbox, if you take the majority of the traffic that people are consuming, isn't a website host in Japan,
right?
It's content that you can deliver locally.
Right.
And so we're able to peer off a lot of our traffic.
So you make a deal with Netflix.
Yeah, so you talk with the sources of content. They don't want to pay transit to get to an internet provider either. And so it's a symbiotic relationship where both parties reduce their costs.
You share a switch. They come into your switch and you come into that switch.
Yeah, you throw a 10 gig across a facility. So you're in
a common... Because that's the other side. You're kind of in the same
You're in
places.
A common facility. Yeah, you're
right.
in the
building.
Same carrier hotels.
Yeah.
And so you just run a cross-connect between our core routers and their core routers, and you do that at multiple points.
What's it look like in those hotels? Are there just cross-connects everywhere
so
going on?
So much yellow fiber. That'll blow your mind.
The yellow is the cross-connect?
Yeah, just so much. Trays and trays overhead full of fiber interconnecting everybody.
Interesting.
And the racket for the carrier hotels is to charge for each one of those. And so you've got your island, and they've got their
island. Charging by bits.
They're charging
by connections.
Per cross-connect. So each party has a cage with a bunch of routers or servers in it, and you want to connect them together. Oh, that's $100 a month to go between the two. And
so that's their business.
That's the business of the carrier hotels is space, power, and cooling.
Right.
Cage.
Of course.
And then, you want to cross-connect to Netflix? Mm. Great. You want to cross-connect to Apple? Great.
But that's a good deal for you.
It is. And but, you know, it's interesting to see that marketplace, as soon as that becomes the place to be, the prices of cross connects go up.
Sure.
They're kind of a sunk cost.
Sure.
They don't really cost $100 a month. You've got a fiber patch running 50 feet. That doesn't really cost anything.
Right.
But so it's a bit artificial. But you know, the goal is to connect consumers with an edge connection that is as fast as possible, ideally a gigabit, and then run a collector ring that is adequately sized to carry all that traffic, and then to transit that traffic to remote sites or peer that traffic at the greatest speeds possible. And so, you know, that's what you'll be experiencing.
What are the, I'm just blue sky. I don't know what the answer is. What is the protocol we're using at this level?
So, I mean, this is just TCP/IP. I mean, this
is still TCP/IP.
This is the foundation of the internet. Yeah. I mean, this is what makes IP so powerful, is that, you know, internet protocol is a technology that was invented so long ago, and it has been extensible.
And it works.
To this point of this massive, massive fabric of interconnection.
Amazing. You're not using Ethernet. You're not using...
Well, it's, I mean, Ethernet is the underlying
layer
of transport technology. Yeah. But it's, you know, so at a physical level, it's
physical
fiber.
At a
logical level, it's Ethernet. And at a transport level, it's IP. And then you have applications, and you think about a sort of stack model.
Yeah, the seven-layer OS.
Yeah, and that's kind of not how network folks think about things anymore. But so it's... In your connection here, and in most of our business connections, it's Ethernet point-to-point. But that second layer for residential consumers is what's called GPON. It's gigabit passive optical networking. So the passive optical component of that refers to that 32-to-1 splitter. That's a passive component. And that allows you, instead of dedicating an Ethernet port in a central office to a customer remotely.
Don't want to do that.
It's expensive to do that.
That's a lot of switches.
You have to build glass the whole way.
Yeah, yeah.
You can build glass half the way and then split it 32-to-1. Or, you know, as the technologies evolve, maybe it's 64-to-1. Or,
and still maintain the speeds.
Yes. And so GPON allows for 2.4 gigabits downstream and 1.25 upstream.
Wow.
And then the end user delivery is typically 1 gigabit.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's next generation PON. There'll be 10 gigabit services. There'll be wave division that allows for multiple 10 gigabits. And so
there's a lot of headroom.
So there's tons of headroom. So the part that is expensive is the physical construction of hanging a new cable on a pole outside your house or burying it in the street.
And the switches.
Yes, but that's a very small segment.
Really?
And the idea here is you build this physical infrastructure. That infrastructure gives you a pipeline, a pathway to every premise. And then every 7 to 10 years, what you'll see is a technology refresh on the ends. So the commodity technology today is GPON, which delivers 1 gigabit. But, you know, 5, 7, 10 years from now, you'll see that getting refreshed, and it'll be technology that delivers 10 gigabit.
Neat.
And so the technology that you have to deliver 10 gigabit to an enterprise here is not cost-effective for a consumer.
Right.
But years from now, they'll be really cost-effective consumer 10 gig products.
Wow.
So, you know, you asked earlier about, you know, Verizon pivoting away from the fixed line business and Google recently putting on pause their fiber efforts in favor of some research and development around wireless. I'm really optimistic that getting a fiber to every house is a key opportunity, and it will take a long time to pay that back. But being the first one to deliver fiber to a home and to deliver a gigabit product today and faster products in future, I think that's a good long-term business. And
you're brave.
But you look at an entity like Verizon.
Upfront cost.
There are a lot of business sectors they could put their investment into.
Right.
And arguably, you think about mobile and Internet of Things and connected cars.
Right.
There's going to be a lot of dollars in mobile
and wireless
communication.
Yeah. Yeah.
So should they put their money into connecting some more homes or into making their currently the number one wireless network in the U.S., making that unassailable?
Right.
You look at, you know, an entity like Google, they would like to get incumbents to upgrade their networks, which arguably they've been successful at. Their business focus is in advertising and video primarily. So pay-per-click with Google search and YouTube and advertising on YouTube. You know, should they be putting their dollars into the next exciting over-the-top thing? Or this boring infrastructure that's going to have a very long return on its investment. Now, I'm not in the search advertising business, and I'm not in the wireless business, so I get to do only, you know, fiber to the premise. And I'm really optimistic about it as a business. We've built a great team. We have a really good business model, the group now were, I found it interesting, Google wants to reduce from 1,000 to 500. We're 330 people now, based here in Santa Rosa.
Wow.
So,
wow.
You know, great local customer service. Yeah. A really, really wonderful group of people, and really enjoying what we're doing.
Yeah, it's not just the bandwidth. It's not just the pipes. You also have to provide the internet layer, the customer service layer.
So I see four things you need. You need the connection. That's table stakes. It needs to be reliable and fast. It needs to be priced right. You need a market price. You need to have good policies and practices. You need to treat customers well. Look out for their privacy with respect to lawful customers. And then lastly, and arguably most critically, you got to take care of consumers.
Right.
We've been abused by so many industries, you know, outsourced and offshored and scripted and cost minimization around customer service. And people really value talking to another person who will listen to them patiently, who will take a moment and digest the history of their situation, who will empathize with the frustration that they might be having, whether it's about their connection or their bill or just their day, and give them customer care in a joyful way.
Yeah.
And
that's a real challenge because you get people really in a bad mood when they're calling. When you have trouble with your internet, that's like you're having a bad day.
Yes, but I think, you know, we find that when they reach our team and we have just
if you have a
really
good interaction,
focused,
it's
yeah,
very
we've really
positive.
Focused on on working with really nice people.
Bravo.
And so when you reach somebody and you're frustrated and you're at your wit's end and you reach somebody who listens to you, who understands you, who isn't, you know, ramrodding a script down your throat, it's a refreshing experience. And, you know, our challenge, I'll say, is scaling that.
Yeah.
Finding enough nice people, finding great people in quantity. And you know, today we've been on kind of a nonstop hiring tear for a long, long time. And that's been a bit challenging. And our hold times have gone up as a result. People are waiting longer to reach us. And, you know, that's not because we want to cut costs of service or we're compromising. It's that we haven't found enough nice people.
Isn't that funny? That's the hardest thing to get.
Yeah, and I mean, there's
but
a lot of great people out
there. But you're swimming upstream because everybody else in the technology business is scaling back on customer service, scaling back on support because those are very expensive. They cut your profits significantly. But you still feel like as a package, despite the expensive infrastructure, the expensive support, that you're able to see a way to profit. And how long? I mean, how long does it take you to make a customer worthwhile? To trench out to them and do
for,
all of that.
For a fiber customer, quite a few years.
It's years.
Yes.
It's a years time
years.
Frame.
And that's all the more reason you need to win their joy and loyalty.
You've spent a lot of money to get them.
Yes. And if you treat customer service as a cost center, like it's expensive to do, so let's reduce the cost of it by sending it to another country, by scripting it or making it challenging to reach, it's very short-sighted. You reduce your costs this quarter, and that might be important as you're reporting to your investors on your results. But in the long run, what you do is you turn customers into haters.
Right.
And we have really found, you know, number one key to the success for us has been to have customers that are fans.
Is that one reason you haven't gone public, because you don't want to be pressured to pay attention to the quarter?
I don't think going public has been – we haven't reached a scale where that would make sense.
And yet this has got to be capital intensive.
But I do really like being able to make those decisions and to not answer to others for them and be able to say, we're going to invest in customer service, not because we have to hit a number this quarter. It's appropriate to invest in it because what we're winning is really loyal fans, customers who will tell their friends about us. Yeah. And
how do you capitalize this? Do you borrow? Do you have?
We borrow.
Yeah.
So we have banking relationships and that's a challenge for us as we've gone from a business that's largely been leasing infrastructure like copper wires, adding services, DSLAMs and infrastructure and providing a service, to one where we're making very long bets
on
fiber. And critically for us, we need to get a very high take rate.
Right.
And so that's one of the reasons that the product is inexpensive. You know, we work hard to ask our customers to you know, talk about us and explain mm-hmm. this mission. Mm-hmm. And fundamentally, the mission is broadband access in America is broken. Consumers are
Everybody knows that.
Consumers are paying too much.
Yep.
They're being treated poorly.
Everybody agrees.
And their privacy is for sale.
Yep.
And that is the outcome of duopoly.
Right.
And so you sweat your infrastructure assets. You don't upgrade. You monetize the customer in every pernicious way. And that's really not the ideal outcome for consumers, right? So our mission is to solve that problem by delivering a product that is great customer service, very fast, reliable,
how much
good
is
practices.
A gigabit?
How much
would it cost to get a gigabit in the home?
So our residential service is $40 monthly.
Not for a gigabit.
Yes, for a gigabit. And that also...
Wait a minute.
So that also includes unlimited nationwide telephone service, all the phone's features, and free calling to...
Can I give you a tip?
And
charge
free calling
twice that, dude.
To fix lines in 66
countries. That's crazy.
Well, I'll tell you why it's 40.
First of all, you're cheaper than the tenth of that speed cable internet.
Well, and the issue here is you can't just capture the customer who cares about performance. So say, for example, you've got customers that are paying...
Yeah, because I would pay $100, $200 because
Leo,
performance is important.
But not everyone
else.
Would.
I understand.
And the issue is you build down the street and you've sunk
you
massive
need everybody.
Costs.
You need everybody.
And so you need to be able to knock on that door and say, whatever you have,
will be
we have a product
will
that is
it.
Not only faster, is yeah. also cheaper yeah. and better in that you know, we do throw people in phone
get,
service.
I mean, I understand they can get the price, but do they get... the word fiber, that seems, I think consumers understand that word, right?
They're starting to, you know, people get confused. We say, you know, 1 gigabit and we see people, you know, thinking that's a gigabyte. And, you know, like right. I get 300 gigabytes in my allowance for my other service.
Right. No. We're
talking
about
a measure
about
of consumption versus,
we're talking a gigabit a second.
Yes. And so that's been a bit of a challenge.
Yeah.
There's also just an inertia in... It's a hassle to switch.
Yeah, nobody wants to do that.
And
right?
it's yeah. a headache. And so that's been a challenge for us. We want to make it really clear to folks that, you know, this is delivered in parallel to whatever they have.
Well, we're also...
It gets up and running. Then it's easy.
So there's
you dump
that, by the way, was a problem with DSL because you had to have a cooperation of
the
ILEC.
To the other.
And AT&T and whoever your carriers would say, well, that's going to take a few weeks.
Right.
You know,
and today, those swaps on DSL take about 10 minutes.
Yeah.
So that is coordinated now.
Good.
But...
Good. That was, to me, that was purely just.
But internet in the home has become so essential that you're like,
nobody can be
offline. It's working, and I hated setting it up, and I hate that company, and I hate paying the bill,
but
I don't want to mess with it.
We're also battered customers. We've had such bad experiences that we just expect you to be yet another bad experience. You know, okay, $40 now, what's it going to be next year, right?
And that is a challenge. Also, declaring that you're delivering good customer service. Everybody says they have good customer service.
No, right.
So we're not a credible source of that declaration. Only our customers are.
Right.
And your customer is not going to, you know, automatically tell everybody how great you are.
Yeah.
These are the challenges.
So wait a minute, $40, I get 100, I get a gigabit. It's not symmetric. Is it symmetric?
It's not symmetric today.
Is it 10 up?
So it's 1 gigabit down, 100 megabit up.
Okay, that's plenty.
And
I get unlimited.
That'll climb.
That will climb.
Yeah.
Why asymmetric?
So we initially did that out of concern for DDoS. So we were worried that customers with compromised hosts would flood upstream.
They would
and
become a problem.
We would have a challenge blocking this in a timely way. And frankly, we would create an impact on others out on the internet.
Right.
In that our customers could become a massive source of traffic.
That's an interesting reason not to do it.
So and then the other theory is, well, you can only go up. So if you roll a product out this way, well, you get something in reserve and you can go up.
Right.
We're talking in the group about offering a referral bonus. So you refer a friend, we'd bump you to 250 meg up.
Nice.
You refer two friends, we'd give you 500
Truth
meg
is,
up.
Though... Nobody needs more than 100 megabits. 100 megabits is amazing.
100 megabits is plenty.
Skype only needs 5.
But when you're uploading video in particular, and you think about folks with one of these drones that shoots 4K or even new iPhones
posting it on YouTube,
that are going to shoot 4K,
you
want to post that to YouTube or whatever. You'd like that to go up as fast as possible.
Sure.
So getting the upstream speed up makes sense. I think we'll do a referral program. You refer a couple friends and you'll get
bumped
up.
That idea. That's a great idea.
It's a marketing idea,
right?
But it's a win-win for us and for them.
Sure.
And so it's currently 1 gigabit down, 100 megabit up.
Unlimited phone calls in the U.S.
Yeah, plus a phone line with unlimited calling.
And it's a regular phone number.
We port in your number. It's regular landline phone service. Yeah. And
that's, by the way, interesting because, of course, the cable company is not giving me landline.
Well, they are. The cable company is giving you, it's voice over IP technology, but it's delivered over a fixed line to your house.
Right.
So the differentiation here is between, you know, there's three technologies. So it's not a POTS landline.
Got
so
it.
A POTS landline, plain old telephone service, right, is like copper twisted pair.
Right. And it's powered, by the way.
It's
which
powered
is
from
one
a
real
central
advantage
office.
Of it. Yeah.
Whereas all of the sort of modern technologies,
right,
whether it's fiber to the node and VoIP to the home, or it's a cable, or it's over fiber, it's voice over IP, and you got to have a battery at the site.
Right.
And then
do you do that?
We do.
Yeah.
And we throw in also unlimited calling to fixed lines in 66 countries. So if they want to call,
this is a pretty good deal.
You know, their mom in the UK or Australia or Japan.
You know the biggest problem, and this is the problem with Google Fiber. Everybody wants it, but they can't get it.
Yes, that is a big issue. And
anybody hearing this is saying, "Well, okay, I'll take it.
Sign me up." And
at least our audience, right?
Well, and that's the thing that's interesting to me is we've got this array of current technology products. You know, DSL and fiber to the node. As we grow the customer base in those products, we take the revenue that comes out of those and we plow it into building more fiber. So roughly for every two customers we add on copper products, we can pass one more home with fiber.
Nice.
And then in the fiber homes that we pass, the goal is to recruit 20 to 30% of those to sign
well,
up for the product.
I was going to say 80%. 20 to 30 is not bad.
It's unrealistic to expect to get to really high numbers because people are too busy to switch,
right,
or they like what they have, or it's good enough.
Right.
They don't understand the new technology.
It's challenging, I'm sure.
And it is. And so if you try and build a business model around a very high take rate,
it's not going to work.
It's unrealistic, and you end up hitting a financial wall in the end.
Right.
But
so 20 to 30 you feel is reasonable and doable.
Yes.
Yeah.
And and so
every third house, every fourth house.
Yeah, we'd like them to be a customer. And in the long run, if we keep the price at a fair, low level, if we continue to deliver great customer service, eventually, why
more.
Wouldn't
right.
the majority
right.
become
win more.
A customer? And this also dovetails into, you know, television and video bundling. And, you know, they're kind of being forced to buy TV, phone, and internet, and they're kind of stuck with that. And
don't have a triple play bundle. You don't have a TV.
So we partner with Dish.
Oh, you
and
do?
So we
right.
do, yeah. So for $80 a month, people can get, so it's $40 for the internet and phone, $50 for the TV, and then you get $10 off the internet and phone. So you get an $80 bundle. And we're really pleased with Dish. They've got a great DVR, the
right.
Hopper 3.
Right.
You can watch it anywhere. It's got the auto hop, which skips the ads.
You know, when we
it's
were
a great TV
oh,
technology.
I think the Hopper is amazing. Yeah.
Point is, they can do a better job of it at their scale,
right.
with respect to their cost of
sense.
Content and technology,
yeah.
than I can do.
You don't want to be in that business.
So it's a good marriage. And so for folks who continue to want conventional TV, we have a great bundle.
Right.
But we're finding the majority are not taking
not
TV
if you
along
have that
with
kind of bandwidth. You've got. You can cut the cord, I think. That's an opportunity.
Yeah, and the question is, you know, do people want live sports? And
well, if you're in San Francisco, no problem. It's up here that we have a problem.
Yeah, it's up here. And, you know, the question also for me is, can you figure out how to put up an off-the-air antenna and maybe one of those Channel Master DVRs that don't have a monthly fee or a TiVo that does, get your off-airs, and then combine that with your Netflix and your Hulu?
So your audience, geeks, you don't have to sell them. They're clamoring.
Yes.
It's the normal people that are challenging.
And so when we look at our customer base today, 80% of our customers don't have pay TV.
Right.
Now, that's
the
abnormal.
Cord cutters.
That's abnormal with respect to the market at large. And when you've got, you know, fiber going past all these homes, you need to have normal.
Right.
You need to have a
get them all.
Get the bundle and just make it vanilla and easy.
We're talking to Dane Jasper, founder and CEO of Sonic, sonic.com, S-O-N-I-C.com, if you're lucky enough to be in one of the Sonic neighborhoods. Boy, I don't know why you would say no. Just What do you do? You leaflet? You know, when we were looking for new studios, I went to every studio we went to. We looked for it because you put a sticker on the door.
We did, yeah.
And I looked for gigabit, and we weren't going to look at a place that didn't have at least gigabit. Yeah.
In commercial areas, business parks, where we...
That's a little easier.
Yeah, where we build fiber down the street. Yeah. If there's a vacant office, we'll put a little sticker on the window, right. And they peel off. We found glue that, like, peels off easily. You don't want to be annoying, right? But you'd like to inform.
It worked.
And
it
so
worked.
A little sticker up there, you know, gigabit-enabled building. We work with brokers.
Yeah.
And in the residential side, we work with realtors.
Ah.
And so, you know, a realtor...
Increasingly, somebody's not going to buy a house without asking first, what's the internet situation?
Yeah, and I think... I'm not sure we've reached that tipping point because I think folks kind of accept that there's just cable and a cable they have to work with and a phone company they don't want to.
Right.
So maybe we haven't reached a point where people recognize there's a third option and they should ask for that yet. But working with real estate brokers, and then in the residential area, we have to do those annoying things that hang on your doorknob when you're not home.
Boy, you got to get the word out. You got to get the word out.
Yeah.
We're going to take a break, come back. I want to talk about the challenges of being an ISP in the modern world in a little bit. And we were going to, and I hope we can still find time to talk about apartments, because that's got to be a gold mine if you can get into one. But apparently, it's hard.
The apartments have some interesting barriers.
Comcast and others have locked them up. We'll talk in a second, but first I want to show you this. You probably don't have this in your Tesla, but I bet your gas vehicles. I know you've got an OBD2 port, the onboard diagnostic port.
What have you got here?
This is cool. This is the automatic. This is OBD dongle, but this is the new automatic. You may not know about this. They just came out with the Automatic Pro. It has unlimited 3G built in, no subscription cost.
Really?
So now suddenly, not only is your car connected via Bluetooth to your phone, your car is connected to the internet, and I like it. They made it gold.
That's nice.
The new gold Automatic Pro is awesome, and we're going to tell you how you can even save some. It works with so many devices, and obviously, of course, with the app, the automatic app on your iOS or Android device, which does things like grades you. It says how good a driver you are. It rewards you with points for not too many, accelerations.
Now, I had the original one of these.
Yeah, this is the new one. So
plugged it into our minivan.
Yeah.
And if you stepped on the gas really hard, it would beep at you.
Yes, it does.
If you stomped on the brake, it would beep at
you. It's helping you be a better, more cost-effective driver.
Yeah, and kind of gamified the
It was fun,
the driving.
It also gives you, at the end, you know how much gas you used and how much you spent because it knows how much your gas cost. You're getting an idea that, you know, going to the Costco to save a buck but costing $2 in gas probably wasn't the best idea, you know. It really helps you. They also are great for teenagers because you have geofencing. It works with If This Then That. If you keep track of business mileage, you can work with Concur, Expensify, FreshBooks to automatically put business mileage right into your account. You can link it to your Nest thermostat. You can link it to your Amazon Echo. You say to the Echo, how much gas is left in the minivan? So you know.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, that's nice.
Yeah, isn't that nice? Or where'd I park my car? Because this one with the 3G now can communicate back wherever your car is. You even get human help in a crash. The Automatic Pro detects severe accidents and will have a trained responder call for help even if you cannot. Any car after 1996 has an OBD2 port. This will work with all of them. iPhone or Android via Bluetooth. It works with the Apple Watch. It works with the Pebble. It is the coolest thing ever. Now, even with all these features, and by the way, 5 years of free 3G, 5 years of free 3G, it's only $129.95, but we're going to get $20 off when we use the offer code TWIT. So they really were able to pack a lot of new features into this for very little cost. $129.95, use the offer code TWIT, $20 off, automatic, just like it sounds, .com/TWIT.
Is there a monthly?
No.
No monthly.
It's free.
Nice.
It's kind of like what Amazon did with the Kindle, right? It had just 3G internet. They must have made a deal. I don't know how they did it. Automatic.com/twit. Every car should have this. And if you have teenagers, you're going to have teenagers. You're going to want to make sure every car they drive has this. Avoid breakdowns.
And do you have a moral obligation to tell the teenager that this thing's under the dash?
Absolutely not.
Yeah.
It's your car.
You call them up, honey. I see that you're doing 85 in a 65.
You can geofence. You can say, honey, you're not allowed to go on the highway.
Yeah.
And when they get home, you can say, we have Ring doorbells. that you can tell when your teenager comes and goes. You should get one of those, too. I'm just telling
the
you.
The Internet of Things is really making it not as fun to be a teenager anymore.
It's no fun.
We got away with all sorts of stuff.
I know. Your parents know everything. And yeah. They always have a cell phone. So we talk a lot about ISPs. You know, remember when the FBI recommended Carnivore and said every ISP should keep 2 years of customer data? And how hard is it to protect the privacy of your customers? There's got to be pressure on you all the time, right?
Yeah, I mean, privacy is, it's a really important topic. I think it's been interesting to see carriers begin to offer lower prices if you're willing to have your privacy compromised.
AT&T's doing that, saying,
That's terrible. I mean, think about that from a social construct. You're going to say to people who can afford it that you can have privacy, but if you're lower income, we're going to snoop what you do. I mean, it's really not appropriate.
That's a really good way to put it, isn't it?
Yeah. It's and if you can afford privacy,
Terrible. Privacy should not be a luxury item.
It shouldn't be. And so that's one side of it is advertisers and carriers as a trusted party carrying your traffic, potentially making it available to advertisers. The other is protecting customers from overreach, whether it's intelligence agencies or law enforcement. And that doesn't mean anarchy, and it doesn't mean hoisting the pirate flag. What it means is protecting customers, lawful customers, from bulk data collection and overreach by law enforcement or by intelligence agencies. Here, domestic or mm-hmm. foreign. And so I won't say, it wouldn't be appropriate to say, come one, come all, come break the law. That's really not the message. The message is if you are a law-abiding consumer, your service provider shouldn't send all of your traffic to an intelligence agency.
It seems obvious.
There should be a warrant.
Yes.
And
but so many do. And, they just cooperate.
Well, you know, there was a case with international traffic and a large national carrier and the EFF and a sort of secret room in San Francisco.
Yeah.
There was a case with telecommunications providers and what are called call data records. That is the digits that you punch on your telephone. So the number you call and how long you talk to them.
Not deemed private content.
It's metadata.
Metadata.
Right? But if you called somebody and then they talked to some other people, how many degrees of separation,
of
like a Kevin
All
Bacon,
of that.
Two
yep.
degrees of separation yep. from
that
bad
whole
guys.
Web is put together.
And it's important that we keep our public safe, but we need to do that while at the same time not compromising our Constitution and lawful consumers' privacy.
Yeah.
And so it wouldn't be appropriate, in my opinion, to take information about all the phone calls that Leo makes, not the content, not what you said, but who you called and how long you spoke to them, given that you're presumably law-abiding, and store all that for a long time. And and so that's a philosophy that I have. And
do you go to court? Will you actually go to court on this
stuff? We have, and you know, and that's another component is, when will you go to court?
Right.
And is every warrant or subpoena that comes in simply fulfilled,
right.
Or is it reviewed? And we don't fight every search warrant or subpoena. It wouldn't be appropriate to do so.
No, and you want to balance the need for national security with the need for privacy.
Yeah,
it's not a one-way street.
And that's why this isn't black and white.
Right.
And this isn't anarchy. But it's important that the consumer have some check and balance, some party between them and the courts or law enforcement.
And I so respect that you fight for your customers. This is the EFF report card. Who has your back? This is from last year. I'm sure you'll do just as well this year. 5 gold stars for Sonic, one of the few people who has your data with 5 gold stars. And that is follows industry-accepted best practices, tells users about government data demands, discloses policies on data retention, discloses government content removal requests, and pro-user public policy opposes backdoors. And you get a star for each of those from the EFF.
Yeah, and amongst internet access providers, we're far and away.
Oh yeah.
You know, if you, and there's a very limited number of internet access
Look
providers.
Look at AT&T, you'll see. yeah.
Amongst, you know, there's a whole other category, obviously, those who host your email or those who right. host your file services right. like Dropbox or right. Gmail. They're an important component as well. And
Dropbox, by the way, 5 stars, so good on them.
Yeah.
There are, Apple is a 5-star company.
Well, and we've seen Apple's behaviors, right?
Right.
So we see Apple standing up for the user, standing up for principles,
right.
And saying, well, we're not willing to backdoor all our products and allow law enforcement right. to have the keys. Right. And I think that's important and appropriate. Yeah. But there are people threatening us and there are people breaking the law. And so, you know, law enforcement does need tools. They do need to be
of
able
course.
To find bad guys.
Yeah.
And so this is the line that you have to walk. And it's just important that somebody is looking out for the consumer.
What is your policy on Six Strikes?
So DMCA and Six Strikes, we don't participate in that, the formalization of that program.
That was a bunch of other internet
yes.
service providers
and,
that agreed to that in lieu of a three yes. strikes.
But the DMCA does require that consumers, the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, right. does require that consumers who repeatedly infringe copyright, that trade in pirated material, do need to have their access terminated. And we have to do that by law.
Yeah.
And we make an effort to inform customers. And if they keep downloading pirated content and we are continually informed about that, they'll have to lose their access.
Right.
And,
but that's a United States law that you know you're working in the U.S.
That
you
is
have
correct.
To adhere to the nation's laws.
That is correct. And so you know this is an interesting one. I think I've long believed that the solution to piracy is not necessarily litigation and prosecution. It's to make access to the content available in a reasonably priced and seamless way.
Yeah.
And so, you know, people would pirate movies that now they can just watch on Netflix.
Right.
And, you know, HBO has gone over the top with their HBO Now product. And
I'm sure that's helped. I think most people will want legitimate access yeah. and would prefer it if it's given to them.
Yeah.
It's just if they can't get it.
The one arena that seems, you know, remains challenging is release windows. And theatrical
right.
releases,
right.
you know, something's in the theater and you want to right. see it soon, you don't want to wait for it to come out. It seems like if consumers are willing to be patient, most content becomes available
right.
to them eventually.
Right.
And so I think the motivation for piracy, you can keep hitting consumers with, you know, lawsuits and prosecution over and over and over again, but the behavior will stop when they can watch or subscribe
right.
to or rent or buy the content in a way that's faster, easier, higher quality,
right.
flexible.
Right.
You know, if you buy something, you want to own it, and you want the same capabilities that you had if it was a,
right.
a disc. You'd like to watch it on a mobile device or take it with you when you move house or whatever. You know, there's questions when someone dies, what happens to their Amazon account?
We don't apparently own anything.
So I think the content industry has really made great strides in that direction. I think that's really the only answer to really quashing piracy is making content available at high quality with reasonable terms.
As you move into San Francisco, you're probably going to apartment buildings. That would be a gold mine for you because it's highly dense population.
We're not.
You're not. Well, and I read this article from Susan Crawford, who's a Harvard law professor, a couple months ago. Actually, it was in June in Back Channel. Building owners getting kickbacks from big providers, in effect, mean that you don't even have access to many of these apartment buildings. The renters are losing out because of these shenanigans.
Yeah.
So you're not going after apartment buildings.
So we're not going after apartment buildings. We do have one in San Francisco that is up and running, but it's very challenging. The typical large apartment building deal is that they will sign a 10-year marketing exclusive. Now, this doesn't lock out other providers,
right.
but it means that when a new tenant comes in and says, I want a lease, what do I do for my internet? That building owner has an obligation to market the exclusive, right. and they also get paid a fee based on the take rate. So they're incentivized to see that carrier serving 70, 80, 90% of the households because then they get a share of that revenue at an escalating level. Right. And so
that's exactly what Crawford says. So, it's illegal to have an exclusive.
Right. So it's not a
marketing deal.
It's not a lockout, but it is a marketing exclusive. Yeah. And typically they run a decade. They'll often have a front-end payment to use the wiring infrastructure in the building, and then they'll have a residual payment that's based on the take rate.
Right.
And so this makes it hard to disrupt that that area.
She says, and I think I'm sure you agree, that city governments should require, every city should require new apartment builds to do what Stockholm, Paris, Brentwood, California, and Loma Linda do, which is require new buildings to be fiber-ready so that any provider can get in there without asking permission.
I mean, ideally, you'd like a neutral territory.
Neutral.
And so, and in Hong Kong, we've seen really great deployment. HKBN in Hong Kong has done really cheap gigabit service. And they've done it because building owners can't do anything exclusive and can't lock anybody out.
Right.
And so it's a rush to get in the building and deliver the fastest, cheapest, best product you can and capture as much of the market as you can.
Ultimately, it's going to be up to government to facilitate this kind of competition.
Sure,
and make
but building owners are going to say, this is private property.
Right.
This is a private property right. This is fundamental to the Constitution and my private property.
No, I understand the arguments against.
But on the other side, you're a tenant and you're caught in the crossfire.
What are my rights?
Like, well, wait a minute, I'm a tenant.
Right.
And I would like the right to choose from 10 different carriers.
And it's in the civic interest, and this is the other side of it. It's in the public interest to have. In fact, all of the conversation we have about net neutrality and bandwidth caps all disappears when you have true competition.
It does, and the challenge is the public is this collective voice, but building owners, for example, are a coherent and cohesive voice that has its own lobbying entity.
Yeah.
And
as always.
And so whether it's an incumbent crafting state laws that disallow municipalities from competing with them, or a set of building owners who's saying, no, we don't want laws that compel access because we have a private property right. The consumer loses.
Well, I hope people watching have a better understanding of why it's a good thing to have this kind of competition, how it solves a lot of things. You know, we even have the debate internally, and I know the EFF has this debate internally. Well, they don't want government regulation, but at the same time, we do want net neutrality. There's a very easy way to solve this, which is true competition, and that's what we want. We need as geeks. Now that we understand, I think if you watch this, you understand the issues. We need as geeks to stand up for that and say we want true competition because that's, in the long run, the best thing for everybody.
Yeah, you don't necessarily need to regulate around things like neutrality, competitive access. If people could choose from 100 providers, they would all behave well. Customer service would get better. Pricing would be
There's always going to be a Sonic that's going to stand up for customers.
And I think, you know, what can consumers do today? I think that they should look beyond the default choice and see if there are alternative choices in their market. And
I always say support your independent.
Yeah, is there an independent service provider? It might be a wireless ISP. Yeah. It might be a building ISP.
They're always going to do better for you.
Is there somebody who can offer you an alternative service? And supporting that, you know, furthers the disruption of that duopoly industry.
Yeah. And the sad state of the affairs, though, is that most people still have two choices.
Yeah,
there isn't a third.
You know, what the FCC has found is for faster than 25 megabits, the majority have
one
choice.
Yeah.
And
that's not competition.
The thing I find really interesting, we look at the business models for fiber construction. If the simple majority of consumers, so 51%, would be willing to buy a $40 a month product, you can build fiber to any metropolitan or suburban market. Urban is a different, or sorry, rural is a different challenge. Yeah. So set aside rural for
population
a moment.
Population density is tough.
But in suburban and metropolitan areas, if 50% of them wanted fiber, the business model for constructing it works.
That's awesome.
And the challenge is convincing people that they want that there is an alternative, getting them to make that change.
Stand up. We got to stand up.
Yeah.
Now, what do we do about rural?
Rural is a whole other challenge.
That's a challenge, isn't it?
The cost of building networks, an issue in rural is they've got copper And it's really long, and the further you go, the slower it goes.
Right, so DSL is
And so DSL
terrible.
Doesn't reach.
Yeah.
Cable also, you know, you've got congestion because you've got X hundreds of households
if
way out
cable.
Over miles.
If they get cable.
If they get cable. So the issue in rural is these costs basically tie back to a construction cost per linear foot of plant.
Right.
And so if you're going to build 100 feet to the next house and 100 feet to the next house because they're, you know, in a suburban environment, that's very different than building an eighth of a mile to
right.
the next house.
Right.
And, you know, when you've got these big sprawling parcels, you think farms and whatnot.
Hey, just out of town here.
Yeah. It can get really costly.
Yeah. And I get calls all the time on the radio show from people who live in beautiful areas. I say, hey, you live in a beautiful area.
Enjoy the view.
Enjoy the view because you ain't going to get the internet.
Now, subsidy is a solution. And the question is, you think about rural electrification. You think about universal telephone service. So twice we have nationally taken up subsidization of these rural markets as a priority for economic development, to make sure the kids don't get left behind, to make sure that everybody doesn't move out of the rural markets and into the cities because there's no internet. And a rural market where the cost of living is lower and people can telework can really help
industries
that are in an urban market.
Fabulous.
And so there's a lot of symbiotic opportunities
there. And great quality
of
life. I mean, that's what people want.
So here in Sonoma County, there is a rural project in Occidental that was just approved. Mm-hmm. And the state of California has the California Advanced Services Fund. And this fund will subsidize up to 70% of the cost of building
right.
new infrastructure.
Right.
And so...
And I know the FCC has a broadband plan. It's not funded as part of the
so,
problem. They
so
have the right idea.
The Rural Utility Service, RUS, has a plan.
Yeah.
The NTIA has a plan, and under the ARRA, the Reinvestment Act,
right.
there was $7.7 billion invested
in
extending out to rural markets. But they remain very challenging because instead of spending, you know, $500 to $1,000 to pass a home, this project in Occidental, the subsidy is over $7,000 per home passed, and that's 70%. So they're going to spend over $10,000
wow.
per home passed.
Holy cow.
And so the return on that investment is going to be really long.
Well, that's why government has to do it.
So, right? And in this case, government is doing 70% of it.
Yeah.
And so we have to decide. We have to decide as a society: is
right.
it important
right.
that a kid who lives on a piece of property that's in a rural environment can do their homework at home?
Right.
And you know, should those folks be well connected? And you know, we decided a long time ago that they should have light, and then we decided they should be able to make a phone call.
Mm-hmm.
And today, arguably, internet access is as essential for what people do. So the subsidization programs have been sort of piecemeal, both federal and state, RUS, NTIA, and in California, the California Advanced Services Fund. But they haven't solved all these problems, and there's a lot of consumers just clamoring for access. And Sonic has stayed away from all of those programs. We haven't found a viable business model, even in the
even with 30%.
Even with subsidization, even only paying 30%. These markets tend to be small. They're isolated. So think about putting a technician in a truck to drive out there to install or fix something. So they're costly to operate. And you might do a project, this project in Occidental. It's a $7 million project. And it's about 400 homes. So, you know, whereas in San Francisco, we're passing and activating 400 homes almost every day right now.
Yeah.
And this project in Occidental, they did a bunch of paperwork and they pitched to the Public Utilities Commission and they got this voted on and approved and then they have to fund it and build it. It's a big boogie. So these projects are challenging and I don't have an easy fix for how we should address those, but... you know, I think rural markets will need subsidization. We need carriers that are willing to step up and take them on. Those processes need to be streamlined, and I think it's very important. You think about kids growing up in these
Absolutely.
Areas and their ability to do their homework and to engage in their education.
Right.
or people looking for a job, or right. for that matter, looking for a spouse. I mean, you, right. today, to do anything, you
everything.
Need the internet, it seems yeah. like. So,
well, Dane, you're a great leader in this space, and I just am very grateful that you're in our area. I'm really grateful for our 10 gigabit
yeah.
internet connect. And
I'm glad we've got you connected.
I'm really thrilled that you've been leading this fight for so long. And you continue to act on the side of the consumer. And I think that's so important. You really are a role model. I hope everybody who's watching takes some action and helps us solve some of these nutty, thorny problems.
Yeah, well, I appreciate the support. And yeah. I feel like I've been doing this for 22 years, and I'm still really enjoying it. I mean, I show up because it's a really fun challenge. I feel like it's a problem somebody needs to solve.
Yeah.
And I work with some great people. We've yeah. we've got a wonderful team.
You're very patient. You're very brave. You're really courageous. And I think you're a visionary. I think you're really looking at the future. And I think that's great.
We're trying to figure out where we need to be in
right.
5-7 years. So we're still
that's tough.
Here. And
that's not an easy thing to do.
And win consumers over as fans. Yeah. And find great employees right. and enjoy what we're doing. You know, show
good.
Up, have fun at work.
Good.
You know, build something important and keep moving.
One thing you can do as a viewer is share this show with friends, family, members of Congress, city council people. They need to hear this too. And I think that if they understand the issues, I think they'll be better equipped to do the right thing. Anyway, thank you, Dane.
Yeah,
really
yeah.
great. And thanks again.
I didn't expect this to turn into such a sales pitch, but...
Well, it wasn't. We were talking about real things, but it happens that what you're doing is so important.
Yeah, well, I appreciate the opportunity to talk about it in the context of what we're doing.
Yeah.
And I'm happy to come back and...
What you're doing is great.
If you want to talk about policy or...
Well, we did,
infrastructure
didn't we?
And those
did we not? I thought we did.
Without as much...
why not put some Sonic in?
Self-promotion, I'm happy to...
No.
Happy
isn't
to chat
great?
With you
he feels
you like.
Bad about self-promotion. Everybody else comes on this show and says, why didn't I get more self-promotion?
Oh, yeah.
Dane says, well, I don't know. Did I talk about myself too much?
Oh, I appreciate the opportunity.
No, we're thrilled. And good luck with your Showtime comedy special in October.
Oh, please no.
That's from Reverend Dan, Reverend DeNugat.
Thank you, sir.
Really great. Thank you, Dane.
When I say get a room mic online, does that mean they can't hear us anymore?
No, they can,
right.
but they hear it through this. What we don't have is a mic. We used to have, and we will have, a mic that mics the whole room so you can hear all the conversation. There's a lot of bits and pieces that, you know, We rushed to get the fundamentals done, and now it's going to be refined.
Well, you really had it dialed in over there.
Oh, man.
It was really dialed in.
It was so sweet over there. It was really sweet. But, you know, we'll get that sweet over here.
Yeah.
It just takes, you know, we brought everything with us. It's not like we don't have it.
Yeah.
It's just, you know.
It's exciting for me to see, you know, from tech TV through today.
Yeah.
And your career arc.
Yeah.
And, you know, we've both been kind of doing the same thing, but different things.
Inch by inch, yeah.
You know, and it keeps changing and evolving,
nice.
and it's enjoyable to see
that. And I'm running
that.
Linux on this laptop, so there you go. There you go.
Now, I haven't been reading the chat room because I have trouble listening
best
and interacting.
Not to anyway, because they'll
but
take
I'll have to
you at
scroll
all
back.
Sorts of...
I'll have to scroll back
scroll
and look
back.
At that. And,
they'll take you in all sorts of...
Maybe they've been slamming me. And...
No. Look at...
given that...
Big thank you for your candid perspective and mission. It's been delightfully insightful. We love Sonic. I mean, people... No. I'm sold on Sonic.
Rev DeNuga is talking about schools and libraries, and that's a good point. Using schools and libraries as anchors to get fiber built into communities is a great one. And it's like you gotta put together that federal program with a state subsidy, with a rural...
Well, that's the pitch when you
it's
have the cable
tangle.
Company come to town and say, we want the regional franchise, they say. And we will give you... And they did this to Petaluma.
Yeah.
We will give you connectivity for your libraries and your schools. And they never did it. But what is Petaluma going to do?
Yeah.
Sue them? There's nothing they can do. So whenever it comes up every 15 years... All they can do is say, well, Comcast, you never did what you said you were going to do. Okay.
Yeah.
We'll do it this time. Yeah. And then what do you do? Oh, we're going to change to who?
Yeah. And they say, well, we
it's
own,
a monopoly.
We own the plant. We've invested in the plant. So
it's a monopoly.
You know, and a city, you know, would get sued if they were to throw out an incumbent, regardless of whether it's coax or twisted pair.
Right.
So you're kind of stuck with them.
Yeah.
And I did an article that I think... The folks who stick around in between here would be interested in this group. If you look for America's intentional broadband duopoly, I wrote this article around maybe 2011, and you know, it talks about how we got here from a regulatory perspective, how we flirted with competition, and then turned a course back to duopoly, and I'm not sure that in this
There's the lovely Michael Powell.
Yeah, I mean, you know, Michael Powell was really instrumental in that in that shift.
And you know, to
he's today a cable industry.
I know, but it's a real revolving door, right? I mean, but in his defense, it wasn't. I think it wasn't clear which strategy would produce results, right? I mean, we now know that that was the wrong strategy.
Yeah, and the premise back then, and this article starts with, you know, you'd have the incumbent phone company, the cable company, the power company with broadband over power lines.
He was real into BBL. He thought that was going to change.
Plus wireless.
Right.
And maybe satellite as a check and balance or rural area. And that if you had these five modes, that would be enough.
Right.
And the you know, forcing telephone companies to open their networks might
be enough.
Eliminate.
Right.
Well, might eliminate investment infrastructure.
Well, and that's so the risk what is the cable companies told him.
That you'd they have said, this you want failure us to launch.
Right. You want us to build out.
Right.
Don't do this because we won't. We just won't. They basically held his feet to the
fire. And the telephone company said the same thing.
Right.
And I remember a quote from the, you know, then chairman of one of the, you know, regional Bell operating companies saying, you know, the shovel's in the ground, but we're not going to turn it over and begin digging and investing in infrastructure till we get regulatory relief.
Right.
And so
I don't blame him.
If you can't grant us a monopoly, so
given
why
those pressures, and he thought there would, you know, it was a reasonable
experiment.
I wonder,
though, because
I don't think it was evil.
European regulators have stuck with the unbundling obligations, and and Europeans get more choices.
Right.
And so. Well, in America, we have...
In hindsight, it was clearly a bad idea.
Yes. And in America, it's not that we don't have fast access. I mean, setting aside rural for a moment, in most urban areas, people can buy a fast product.
Right.
But they pay so much for it.
We don't have a choice.
Compared to Europe and Asia.
Well, that's when you say $40 for gigabit.
And isn't that great?
Those are Stockholm prices.
And
that's amazing.
The reason that the pricing... There's two reasons that the pricing is and needs to be so low. All of our products are 40. So whether you're on ADSL 2 Plus and maybe you're getting 15 megabits, or you're on VDSL 2 and maybe you're getting 30 or 40 or 50, you're on a fiber to the node product and you're getting 20, or on fiber, it's the same price. It's $40. What's nice about that for us is we can accumulate a block of customers in an area, serving them with today's technologies.
And convert them over.
Build a new fiber network when you get enough of them.
Yeah.
And then just say, you're being switched.
Good news.
Yeah, good news. You're going to switch. As opposed to, would you like to pay more and can we upgrade you? Because then you end up with your feet in both boats. You got people who won't upgrade.
You have to preserve an incumbent business. You don't want to
do
that.
So you want to be able to shift from one to the other. So that drives the prices into harmony with each other. And then why 40 instead of 50 or 60? I mean, you'd pay the sort of nominal going rate for gigabit seems to be 70 to 130.
Right.
And so where it's competitive, it's 70, and where it's not competitive, it's 130. And so you could build a network and you could launch a $70 product, or if there was an absence of competition, a $130 product. But what you get there with market share is like 5%. You get, you know, technology early adopters.
Right.
And people who are not at all price sensitive.
Right.
And the lion's share of the cost is in building the network past all the homes.
Right.
Connecting more of them doesn't really bring much in the way of costs. So
I would jump on your product.
So you
want
to,
if it were available.
You really want that very high take rate.
I'm paying $200 a month for Comcast business class service in my house, and it's 100 megabits.
Yeah.
And in fact, what's funny is the DOCSIS 3 consumer grade is 250 megabits.
Yeah. But you don't get static IPs, and
I pay for static IPs. It's $20 a month for a static IP.
Yeah,
but you do. But you're right. I can't. You know, I can't serve and all that stuff.
Right. And
that's crazy. That's why we have the business classes, so I can run a server.
Yeah. So I mean, my hope is that we can convince, that we can message the public that this is a problem we can solve if enough of you sign up.
Do you have fiber going down the boulevard?
Which boulevard?
Petaluma Boulevard. Do you have fiber at all in Petaluma?
Oh, yeah. I mean, we have fiber to your office.
Well, clearly, yeah.
Yeah. And so we've...
But not you have consumer fiber?
Correct. We haven't yet done consumer in Petaluma. So what we've done is the business park's at the north end of town here.
Yeah.
And built all new fiber, brought it downtown.
Of course.
We cherry-picked the most lucrative opportunities. Right. And then we have the railroad line all
right.
the way
the
from...
Smart
the smart line. The whole yeah. line is backbone.
And oh, is it? Interesting.
Yeah, so we've...
It's like Sprint.
Yeah, so we've put, Southern Pacific.
Southern Pacific.
Yeah. And,
if you're laying rails, you might as well put some wire in the ground.
So residential, though, is interesting in Petaluma, particularly the portion that is aerial served, so the western portion of Petaluma, where there's overhead pole lines, means lower costs. And
Of course it does. Yeah,
so
yeah.
as we...
We're just outside of city limits. We're on Gossage and the Boulevard.
So you want us to get all the way out there?
Yeah.
I can't promise you anything.
But it is aerial, except it's aerial to our cul-de-sac, and then it's all underground.
Yeah. And that's a challenge.
Who owns that underground? I think we do, right?
No. So the
city?
Underground conduits.
It's not city.
No,
it's county?
It's AT&T and Comcast.
AT&T, those bastards.
So the incumbent carriers own the conduits that are underground. And so a new carrier would have to trench up the road and put in a new conduit.
Right.
And so, you know, our focus right now is getting San Francisco complete. Then we'll move on to other cities
right.
around the Bay Area. We'll look at Southern California.
I'm never getting it.
You know, the goal is to keep going. Well, Petaluma's, the North Bay Area is a good market for us because a lot of people know us here because we've been in business here for more than 20 years.
Yeah.
So the North Bay, we've got a few markets in the North Bay that we're looking
weren't you going to do Occidental? Wasn't that going to be a gigabit project?
Well, so what we did in Occidental was we brought DSL there. So we were the first to bring anything there.
Because it's so rural. Yeah,
yeah, so there was no DSL out there. So we brought DSL out there. And then this carrier that pursues these rural subsidies, and they've done like Boron, California. I don't know where that is.
I don't know where it is. Sounds like the desert. Sounds like outside Bakersfield.
Doesn't sound like a...
Highway 58.
Yeah, down south. So it doesn't sound like a fun place. Boron, California.
Boron.
Sounds boring.
It feels like there might be mining going on.
Something
there.
Like that. Yeah. And so,
Borax.
Huh?
Borax.
Yeah, Borax. 20 mule team Borax,
yeah.
baby.
So so this carrier specializes in these tiny communities in the middle of nowhere, so to speak. And we have fiber to Occidental because we used it to deliver our DSL. So they said, well, you sell us backhaul? We can't build this thing without...
Right. Right.
Backhaul.
We need a backhaul.
So, we're happy to sell you backhaul. And
that's the beauty of fiber. It's got so much capacity.
So
once you put it in.
So a conventional way to look at that might be to say, well, they're a competitor and they're in my backyard here in Sonoma County and I don't want to let that happen.
No. Yeah.
But I don't have organizationally the bandwidth to take on every bespoke project scattered here and there.
Yeah.
So if they want backhaul, I'm happy to provide it. And we do that for wireless ISPs up the coast. So, you know, up in Ukiah and Willits, there's like people who want to send wireless off into the hinterlands.
Right. That seems like the best prospect for wiring rural areas.
It's a very good one, particularly as wireless gets faster and faster.
You know, WiMAX was such a disappointment. We really thought that was going to be the rural solution.
And that has kind of died, but...
5G's... coming along.
So I mean 5G as a family of technologies you know will continue to advance all this stuff. The question is how much of that just ends up in the hands of carriers who own licensed spectrum and tower sites, and how much of that can a wireless ISP like a small company with 10 employees that doesn't own any spectrum, can't bid on any spectrum, and has limited regulatory compliance capabilities, what can they do? And so it's important to further technologies that can be credibly deployed by small operators that are scattered around the pockets of
that
the country.
That makes sense, yeah.
And
so what would that be? Some sort of micro MMDA?
You know, it's unlicensed or lightly licensed. The 3.5 gig stuff would have sort of a centralized licensing. So the idea is a broad swath of spectrum. I think it's good spectrum policy.
It's basically just kind of Wi-Fi.
Kind of in the Wi-Fi area, but at much higher power levels combined with MIMO. And when
I've been reading about the MIMO thing. That just,
so
yeah, that's
when you do all that stuff, and then instead of auctioning off the spectrum to the highest bidder and returning billions to the treasury, instead you say, this big broad swath of spectrum.
It's unregulated.
Is going to be open to all operators.
Right.
And then to keep them from stepping on each other, we're going to coordinate with a centralized database. And so you'll basically, moment by moment, take slices. You'll say, well, we're about to deliver a bunch of spectrum, a bunch of bandwidth over here. We're going to use this spectrum up. And that would get coordinated through a database. And those kind of efforts, I think, are interesting because you've got this rural market and then there's nothing else going on there.
Right.
You end up having lots of capacity.
You own it,
which you need.
Yeah.
And in a more congested market, there's less to go around. And so maybe you have to bring fiber closer.
Right.
And then the stuff that's happening in 60...
But it's all going to be piecemeal in that.
Yeah, there's no one like, here's the solution, boom. So in the 3.5, with coordinated use of spectrum, that's an interesting future. The millimeter wave stuff between 60 and 80 gigahertz will, I think, continue to see interesting development there. So that's like pencil width beams,
right?
But with beam
nothing
steering,
in between.
But with beam steering,
oh, interesting.
You could begin to do point to multipoint without that same aiming,
like beam forming, kind of.
Yes.
Yeah. Wow. Interesting.
And.
Interesting.
And then the area, the section of spectrum where that's been lowest cost has been 60 gigahertz. And 60 gigahertz is absorbed by oxygen. And so it would only go like 300 meters, right? So it could go fast, but not very far. And
people are using probably building to building, stuff like that.
Yeah,
right?
So building to building with really close buildings.
Right.
And then you got to go to 70 or 80 gigahertz to go further. And faster, and therefore they cost more.
Right.
So we have a building-to-building link that's a 2 gigabit building-to-building link. It's a mile and a half or so, and the equipment costs nearly $10,000.
Right.
Well, you can't put that in somebody's house,
no.
Right? It's too expensive, and it has to aim like really precisely at this. So you're not going to do 2 days of aiming and dedicate an antenna on a tower to one customer.
Yeah.
So as those technologies move down. You know, the idea might be you use 80 gigahertz to deliver. There's 2 gigabit can be carried over that today, but there's 5 and 8 gigabit. So you might use that to go like tower to tower, building to building.
Right.
And then 60 gigahertz to tilt down to get to things that are within a kilometer.
Are cell companies looking at this for backhaul and stuff like that?
Yeah. And so some of this millimeter wave stuff, so when you say 5G, it's like this big playbook.
It's a marketing term.
So it's this big playbook of sort of next generation wireless.
Right,
and
right.
So millimeter wave backhaul would be a piece of that.
Right.
And so the combination of high millimeter wave, 70 and 80 for building to building, and then in the 60 gigahertz where you have that oxygen absorption issue, it's a tongue twister, the FCC just voted in some spectrum that's at the high end of the 60s that isn't attenuated by the atmosphere as much. And so there's some promise that high 60 would do some interesting things.
Interesting.
And then this massive MIMO stuff in the 3.5 and other licensed bands of spectrum. So I think, you know, you look out 15 and 20 years, you know, there's this Jetsons future of connected everything and self-driving everything and no more automobile accidents and, you know, high bandwidth video conferencing in your brain or whatever. I mean, and, you know, we'll get there.
Right.
Right. And as a builder of fiber, I feel like that fiber will, like where today it's the drain from the house. In the future, it'll be the drain from the access point that's outside the house or that's on the corner.
So this is an investment in a future that will be...
And it's not one bet or one trick.
A lot of things,
And
the Occidental backhaul is a good example, right? You laid that fiber.
Yeah, and then somebody
purpose.
Else wants to do something else, great.
Yeah.
I can, you know, I can do it as backhaul.
Right.
And so that gives me more confidence to invest. And you know, bringing fiber down every street...
That makes sense.
You know, it could be that... 10 years from now, wireless is the answer. But I might not be then bringing it into the home for half the homes.
Right.
I might just be stopping at the pole and delivering there.
Right.
So you know, but it is.
Good for you.
You do need to be willing to take risk and invest and take long
but
view.
No risk, no reward. And I'm thrilled that you're taking the risk.
Well, it's a fun.
I think it's the smart risk.
It's a. I hope so.
I think it is.
I don't know. I mean, I look at a utility pole, and you got this old, big telephone cable at the bottom that's been there for 50 years.
Right.
And then, you know, 1 foot above that, you got this cable line. And that cable line has turned out to have a lot more uses than they thought it would when they put it into place in the, you know, late 70s, 80s, and 90s.
Well, they monetized that to hell. They're crazy.
And it has dominated.
Right.
Well,
there's one more layer.
If I'm the first one to pin the next thing up there or in the ground, and it's fiber, it has certain uses today, and I think it'll have expanded uses in future.
You're right.
And just
it
like has cable has dominated,
yeah.
I think whoever builds fiber first will dominate if they execute well and market well, gain market share. And so it's been a little surprising to see Google waver from that course. And I think, you know, consumers are sad about that.
Yeah.
And we've had, I've had three people in the last 2 weeks from Palo Alto and San Jose reach out to me, you know, where these are markets that
we're going to be,
they
Google
thought
we're
going to go
markets,
and then it's on pause.
Yeah.
And so there's a subset of the public, these technology early adopters that are in the know that are really sad about that.
Yeah.
So it'll be interesting to see what happens next. And I think, you know, if I were to predict, I think what we'll see is a lot of Google Fiber apartment buildings, despite the marketing exclusives and the barriers to entry.
Well, that's why they bought Webpass, right?
Well, and Webpass has about 800 buildings that they had door access to. So you've got 800 contracts.
Right. Oh, Malik has Webpass in San Francisco.
He's been raving about it. Yeah, and Charles Barr is the CEO there. He's done a really nice job. They've had a strong focus on a simple product and good customer service.
Right. No, I think you're right. I mean, that acquisition shows where Google
does. And so if you could date 800 buildings, and, you know, a lot of those are 100 megabit fed.
Yeah.
If they could bump those to gigabit fed.
Right.
If they can use the fiber that's in a lot of those buildings.
Right.
So if you're in a tall apartment building, the cellular service goes...
It's terrible.
Unless there's a distributed antenna system.
Right.
Which is served by fiber.
Right.
And so by definition, most of these big buildings have...
They already
fiber
had
into
it.
Them.
Wow.
So it's kind of turnkey if you can get the tenants to want this. And so you see this in the messaging on their website. You look at some of the new cities, and it's like there's all these pins on the map, and they're apartment buildings. And you click on them, and they show you the website address and the phone number for the leasing office. Because the goal is to drive consumers to want to live in these apartments.
Right.
And then the apartment owners in an apartment that doesn't have this will beat a path to the door of the carrier and say, well, we better let you in. And never mind that marketing exclusive.
Yeah.
We're going to start marketing.
Yeah.
We're going to stop talking about those guys and just, well, we might have a variety of things, including maybe Google Fiber. And,
It's a shame, though, because Google must share your vision. I mean, I'm sure they're smart enough to know what you're talking about. And it's hard to think why they might have abandoned that. They have the money to do that.
Well, that's a question. I mean,
if it's short-sighted.
If what you're trying to do is solve this problem nationally, there's an argument to be made that if they can connect every apartment building that has more than 80 units in it across the entire country...
That's significant.
That's significant.
Yeah.
And might cost as much as building 10 more cities or 5 more cities.
Right.
And so they can spread it a little more thinly, but maybe have a bigger impact.
Yeah. Yeah.
And if it's about... changing the conversation so that consumers are saying...
That was always the question. Why are you doing this?
Hey, cable
is it a business?
Company, why do I have a usage cap? Or, hey, phone company, why is this slow technology?
Right. That might be sufficient.
And if prodding the customer to prod their carrier or prod their building owner, if that achieves the outcome of you know, faster connections to consumers, which equals higher def YouTube and and people
well, that
see
answers
more
the
ads.
Question of why Google was in this business. Was it a business for them, or was it merely a way to foster more internet usage? And I think we see the answer now, right?
It's
too bad, though.
I think they had convinced themselves that it was a business. I think they may not have recognized
how long term,
the return on capital would be, and how misaligned that is with the rest of their business.
Yeah.
And then number two, how just. There's barrier after barrier, and it's really a
ground
game.
Well, that's what I admire about you. You play that ground game. You grind it out.
Yeah, you have to. Otherwise, you quit.
But your willingness to do that is remarkable. I don't.
It's sometimes wearying.
Oh, it's got to be.
There are times when I'm like, all right, I've had enough.
I give up.
Yeah, and that really.
Well, don't give up.
The cities are sometimes a barrier.
Oh, I know. You're dealing with every possible. Nightmare, bureaucrat, and
And so, you know, we have this ranking of cities. Like, we're building these business parks. Well, here just in the North Bay.
You're still on the air. Just be careful.
In the cities. No, I know. I'm aware. and I'm not going to name the cities and how they're ranked. But the point is there's cities that are easy to work with.
Mm-hmm.
And you get a permit in four weeks.
Yep.
And the permit costs are low. And, and the inspectors show up. And they, go, great. And then there's other cities where, you know, the permit takes 3 months. Yeah. And the fees are egregious. And there are cities now where in order to deploy new underground construction technologies like micro trenching, they're requiring the carrier who puts that infrastructure in the ground to give part of it to the city and sell part of it to competitors. Now, that might be a public good.
Kind of disincents you.
But it also...
So micro trenching, you don't cut the ground, you kind
of... You cut a slot. Yeah. So imagine like a big skill saw.
Yeah.
You cut a slot 12 to 18 inches deep and 3/4 of an inch to an inch wide. And then you take a stack of conduits that looks just like this, and they're about that size, and you drop it down into the bottom of the slot. And
do you treat it in any way? Do you cover...
And then you fill it in with a concrete or an asphalt, depending upon what you're cutting.
Right.
And so... Some cities don't allow this. And
why not?
Good question.
It seems like the least intrusive way to do it.
Well, there's some history here. In the 80s, cities didn't have cable.
Right.
They had telephone only.
Right.
And they had antennas and they had
right.
And the cable companies came and said, "Hey, we want to put in cable. And we're going to roll down your streets with a thing called a rock wheel," which digs a trench.
That's what they used outside our studio.
About 2 feet deep and about 3 inches wide.
Yeah.
And, you know, you got these beautiful streets, asphalt, and it's all gorgeous.
They trash
and then
the street.
You cut this slot,
yeah.
And then when you fill it, it always
is
funky and it grows a bunch of weeds and stuff. And so the cities in California attempted to stop this.
Yeah.
And this went all the way to the California Supreme Court because it's a public utilities easement. It's a right of way.
Right.
And this is a legitimate public utility. Right. They would like to get their cable down the street.
Right.
And so the way that that broke down is that the cities could not bar a public utility from constructing down the street, but they could define methods of construction and reinstatement.
Interesting.
So what they said is, you want to cut a slot a certain width? Well, you're going to have to actually overcut it this much.
And
reconstitute it a certain way.
Yeah.
No, not necessarily. Some cities have done that.
Why do they want a wider cut?
Well,
it's not as
because this little narrow cut trashes the street.
Right.
And so if you're going to cut, we're going to make you resurface the whole street.
The whole street gets
resurfaced. You're going to pass a corner. Got we're going to make you put an ADA.
Right.
Those little yellow bumps.
Yeah, we're getting
a lot
of those for some reason. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. And
now
so,
I know why.
So all these... touch points create opportunities for the city to not see the infrastructure degraded. And and you could take the city's side, right? They put in they have a nice street. They resurfaced it three years ago.
Right.
And now you're going to run this big saw down the middle of it and make it look awful and take its lifespan and reduce it.
You'd think they'd like the micro-trenching, though.
Well, so the micro-trenching fell into the same thing because...
It's narrow.
It's narrow. So you had this 3-inch thing, and that was a blight.
Right.
And so we set all these standards that made it hard to do that. Well, now you want to do a 1-inch thing. Well, we already have standards that don't let you do anything less than a foot.
Right.
Because we want this...
Rebuild.
Rebuild. Yeah. So you do a foot, and if you go down more than a certain length, then you have to stair-step it out. It looks like a little inverted pyramid.
Oh, my God.
You have to put non-compactable fill and then aggregate base and asphalt and so on. And so the micro-trenching kind of got accidentally outlawed before it was ever invented.
Right.
And then along we come with a, you know, 8-inch, 10-inch, 12-inch, 18-inch.
Non-intrusive way of doing it.
Narrower slot.
Yeah.
And they say, well, that kind of fell into the same category.
But it wouldn't be as undermining to the street as...
Correct. Yeah. And you can do it, it's typically done kind of where the concrete and asphalt come together,
right at
the gutter pan.
There. Yeah.
Or it can be done, you know, you have a curb, and then there's like an expansion joint, and then the sidewalk.
Mm-hmm.
So you can cut the concrete there
and
stick it in there. Yeah. So there's some interesting new underground technologies.
Maybe they'll come around.
But they're all more costly than
right
up on poles.
Right. And so poles are always preferred if you can get there.
Yeah, and they're ugly and people don't like them.
Right, and modern construction doesn't have it.
Right, so. And so ironically, what we'll see is, like, as we analyze Petaluma,
it's increasing costs as you rebuild.
Yes. Yeah. So what'll happen as we study, so obviously we're working to finish San Francisco, and that's our focus. But as we wrap up that up, we'll look at other cities.
You're better off with a
older home,
older
neighborhood. Yeah. Yes. And so as we look at where can we build a broad swath of fiber,
right,
and you know, lowest possible cost, right, highest possible
take rate. You're kind of locked out of my neighborhood because of AT&T and Comcast.
Well, we're not locked out.
You could do it.
Economically,
you're a utility.
Would
right.
it be
right.
viable?
It's not feasible. Yeah.
And so, you know, we have to start with the areas where the costs are the best.
Now,
and
if
work
you jump
way.
On it, PG&E's replacing the water pipe all the way up our street. You could just pop it right in there.
Yeah. So
they're digging up that whole street.
Yeah. And it's interesting because you look at sewer upgrades and water main replacements. And these are huge impacts.
Mess.
And
they're doing it all over Petaluma right now.
So we encourage cities.
I guess ours is a gas main. But
Well, so we encourage cities to adopt dig once policies.
Yes.
Where
as long as you got it open.
If we're open at the trench, put in extra conduit.
Yeah.
And make that conduit available to whoever wants to use it.
Yeah.
And if cable wants to use it, or an incumbent phone company, or a new carrier, whatever.
Yeah. And you can charge them.
Yeah. And, you know, at least recoup the costs, the incremental cost of putting it in.
Right.
City of Brentwood is the only one that's done a really great job of that. And the result has been, you know, every time somebody builds a new subdivision, there's available conduit. And as a result, those new homes are getting gigabit fiber from Sonic.
Nice.
And so we'd like to see more cities do that. And we've begun to socialize that, but we haven't got any cities here in the North Bay that have taken up the idea.
I won't put you on the spot. I just know that Petaluma seems very backward in this regard. Actually, Lisa used to deal with the Petaluma.
In all of Sonoma County, Petaluma has been the easiest to work with for us.
Oh, I'm glad to hear that.
They've been really prompt on permits.
Good.
Their inspectors are great. And
that's good to hear.
So in that kind of list,
we're doing okay.
Petaluma's been great.
Good.
So I have nothing but good things to say about them. I can't talk about the other end of
the list. No, don't tell us about the losers.
You know, the internet's a great thing. It's a great place. It's a great set of resources. Getting there has always been this awful toll.
Yeah.
And it can be better than that.
It's getting better.
Yeah. Well, I'm working on it.
Thanks to people like you. Sonic.com if you want to know more and find out if you're lucky enough to have Sonic in your area.
Yeah, and if you're not, like, look for competitive internet wherever you
are. I think that's
a
great message.
I mean, I think that's important.
There are often alternatives that you just don't, that are uncovered.
Well, yeah, I mean, if you're in Kansas City, buy Google Fiber.
Right.
If you're in,
right,
you know, Miami, buy Webpass.
Right.
I mean, there's places, there are other carriers. We're not the only example.
Find those other guys and if you can,
support them.
Support them. Thank you, Dane. I appreciate it.
Yeah, of course. Thanks, Leo.
We do triangulation every Monday, 11 a.m. Pacific, 2 p.m. Eastern, 1800 UTC. We're going to be moving over to the new living room set. I think by next week we'll have our set built up. We are in a brand new studio, so apologies if the sound or video is not up to snuff. I think we did a pretty good job.
It's nice to see it coming together.
It's coming together. It's nice when the plan comes together. You can so do tune in if you can live and join us in the chat room at irc.twit.tv. But don't worry if you can't, because every show is on demand, audio or video. Well, at our website, twit.tv/TRI, or on your favorite podcatcher, whether it be iTunes or the, you know, Twit apps on every single platform, including Roku and Apple TV. But do subscribe. You don't want to miss an episode. This is always a fun show and interesting
show. Leo, it's great to see the new studio. Obviously, I saw you in the
You were
brick
in our
house,
old studio, yeah.
And before that, the cottage.
The cottage. You've been in every one of them.
Tech TV in San Francisco. I mean,
that's
back,
right.
Back
when
you were,
we go back way back.
And it's great to see the new studio.
The evolution.
I know.
Right?
So we've both been in the business for a long time. We keep occasionally reconnecting. So,
well,
thank you very much again for having me on.
Thank you, Dane. Hey, now we're in the new studio, the East Side Studio. We're live. We're on the air, and I apologize for any discombobulation because we're still, you know, hooking it all up. I think we've got it down pretty well. We have created commemorative items for your purchase, and as always, for a limited time. These are limited time exclusives. We got T-shirts, we got mugs, we got hoodies. I know a lot of people want hoodies. We have stickers, all with our beautiful new East Side Studio logo. Thank you, Anthony, for designing that. He did a great job. And as I think we're going to do this 30-day thing as usual. So it's Teespring. Go to TEESPRING.com/twit. We price them to move. We don't price them to make a lot of money because we want you to be able to celebrate this brand new studio with us. Custom T-shirts, mugs, hoodies, and stickers. TEESPRING.com/twit. And we'll see you next time on Triangulation.